Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is August 1st, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is summertime. It's that time of year when things slow down. The world goes into slow motion. People are out. We're at the beach. We're on vacation. We're reading a book, and the U.S. Congress is in their districts and not in Washington. Wall Street, everybody's out in the Hamptons. In Europe, the Parisians have all gone south. It can feel like a recession, but don't assume it is. It may just be summertime. Let's see what the fall brings. The song says, "Summertime and the living is easy." I'm hoping you're taking some easy time these days. I'm headed up to New Jersey this weekend to record my dear friend and longtime ally, Eunice Boston, this weekend for the Soleri Report. I'll talk about that more as we close. And then I'm on to Rhode Island and Connecticut for a series of business meetings. I will be working, but at least I'll get a chance to see the Atlantic Ocean and to digest a few more Andrew Vax books on tape as I drive. Upcoming events, I'm going to be over at the Polyface Farm, Farm-to-Consumer Legal Defense Fund on September 7th. Anybody who wants to be a contributor can come. It's in Southern Virginia. October 4th, 5th, and 6th, I'm going to be speaking at the Casey Summit out in Tucson, Arizona. October 4th to 12th, I'm going to be at the Breakthrough Energy Movement at the University of Colorado in Boulder. One of the subscribers just wrote this week and said that they were coming. Would we organize a subscriber lunch? What a great idea. Yes, absolutely. We will organize a lunch in Boulder. Contiguous with the Breakthrough Energy Movement, and we'll get that up and working and figure out a place way before the conference. So great idea. Thank you, Janet. October 30, I'll be speaking at the annual fall conference of the San Francisco Real Estate and Appraisal Society. I'll be talking about what's next, primary trends in the global financial markets, and the impact on San Francisco Bay Area real estate. Money and markets. Well, we're all Fed watchers now. We've had several years of quantitative easing, and literally we're watching the entire global financial and commodities markets organize and trade off the every word from the Fed. Things got much more Fed watchy in June with the taper tantrums we've talked about. This is combined, of course, the big mystery is when will quantitative easing QE3 be over? And that's added to the uncertainty is when will Ben Bernanke step down as chairman of the Fed and who will replace him? The silly business reached a crescendo this week with the number one article in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week being something called Obama's Fed Circus. And the politicking over Ben's replacement really had reached a level of sort of political circus. Lots of people clearly lobbying for Lawrence Summers, the former head of Treasury. And if you look at Summers' role with engineering the housing bubble or the $4 trillion missing from the federal government or the suppression of the gold price, the thought of Larry Summers being the next Fed chairman is just unimaginable, but there you have it. Lots of talking back and forth about that. In the middle of everything, the Federal Court of Claims ruled that Bernanke had to testify in Hank Greenberg's latest lawsuit over the Fed takeover of AIG. That's, to me, really a comment on where things are that Greenberg could be pulled into, or that Bernanke could be pulled into testify in Greenberg's case. But what it means is that the tensions in Washington over this particular appointment and what the Fed does is reaching a new level of tension. And so we have on Wednesday the Federal Open Market Committee meeting for 2 hours and announcing, yes, they will continue $85 billion of purchases every month. As you know, my theory is that they've pretty much pulled in the fraudulent paper, and now it's really a question of when the markets can tolerate bringing the paper in. The market response, the S&P hit 1,700 and above for the first time. If you look at the charts, and let's look at the charts, Justin has some great slides and charts up on the Instant Teleseminar if you're watching, and I encourage you to take a look at them. But if you look at the charts, not much else is doing well. The media keeps highlighting how well the S&P is doing, and so we tend to have a notion that the markets are doing well. But just about everything else is struggling. Bonds are struggling. Gold is, and precious metals are staying down. The emerging markets are down as the pendulum swings back to the development markets. Dr. Farrell, in the interview that we did with him this evening, we talk a lot about that pendulum swinging back and what it's about. China has announced that they are doing an audit of government debt. That includes all their local government agencies. That's a very big deal. China's legal and financial infrastructure is widely distrusted on the world stage. And if you've ever spent any time in China, you would understand why. The Chinese are very, you know, they're extremely entrepreneurial, but they can run ahead of the kind of legal and financial infrastructure you need. The new leadership really does seem bent on reform, and if they are successful and manage to get real sort of financial and legal controls in place for the kind of infrastructure you need to grow the growth potential that China has, if they're successful in that, and Chinese infrastructure, particularly the intellectual infrastructure, becomes powerful, it's going to really help fuel China as a new global leader. Anyway, but the local governments in China borrowed heavily as part of keeping growth going during the financial crisis. The last audit published in 2011 showed the local government debt at U.S. about $1.7 trillion, and that number is a very important percentage of total bank lending in China. So an audit of the local government units is going to have a big, or could have a big impact on the banking sector in China. China is not the only federal government hitting on local governments. We are watching a tremendous effort in the United States to, at the federal level and at the leadership level, to really go after state and local governments and pension funds in a way which is highly political and not anywhere near based in the facts and evidence, I think. Part of this is kicked off by using Detroit as a whipping boy. There's a new and very, of course, we have Detroit in the equivalent of bankruptcy, and all sorts of things are going on. But the financial manager now has wide latitude to do many things in terms of the obligations to retirees and to the unions. And it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. This effort to target the pension funds has big implications, not just for retirees, but for local taxpayers. Because the pension contributions could go far in terms of how they hit the budgets and how that hits services. So this is something that has impact for all of us. And finally, there's implications for the municipal bond market. We see Meredith Whitney back on the financial press talking about the extent to which the municipal bond market could be impacted. If you haven't listened to the interview we did, Joe Mysak from Bloomberg, on the municipal bond market, very much worth listening to. I think a much more measured presentation. But we do have municipal areas that are in trouble. And if anything, the reason they're in trouble is because of bad behavior on the federal government's part. This is a little bit like watching the rapist blame the victim. We had the financial coup shift assets out of the country in ways that really harmed the municipalities. Of course, the municipalities were encouraged to do all sorts of bad things during the housing bubble, which bubbled their revenues. And but the burst left them in trouble. It really left the pension funds in trouble, who'd bought a great deal of the mortgage paper and, of course, have big treasury positions, treasury securities, so they've been drained by the debasement as well. So the fraud bubble's engineered by the federal government, and then the debasement and the lowering of interest rates to finance the federal government have both drained the pension funds. At the same time, a lot has been done to stabilize most of them. And if you look at their problems, I would say the last thing contributing, or very low on the list contributing to any financial problems, is profligate spending on the behalf of state and local employees. So it's very interesting. Michael Hudson had a piece recently where he pointed out, you know, every time we say there's no money for retirees, we don't seem to have any problem coming up with trillions to give away to the banks or to fund war in the Middle East. So there is a double standard in terms of when we do and do not have money. It's one of the things that Dr. Farrell and I talk a lot about in the interview this week, the idea that we're leaving the state, and not just state and local, but the retirement obligations in the old legacy systems over on one side of the economy, and then we have a financial coup d'etat that pulls $40 trillion out and puts it in the new economy, a.k.a. the breakaway civilization, and suddenly, voila, there's no money. But, of course, there's plenty of money to finance all the things going on over on the new side. The Economist had a series of articles this week, and including great. If you want to do a hit on the state and local pension funds, they did a very slick job. It's not backed up by the facts, but it's certainly very slick. One of the things they mention is the quote-unquote vibrancy of the private sector versus this clunky, old, inefficient, corrupt government. If you look at the real facts of the case, the amount of money that has been used to subsidize or transfer assets at below market value to the private sector to create that vibrancy is absolutely enormous. And the thought that somehow government is inefficient and the private sector is vibrant and efficient is so in defiance of the facts that it is, as my uncle, who used to be a colonel in the Army, would say, it's stupefying. Just remember, government has had a negative return on taxpayers because it's funding a very subsidized positive return over there in the quote-unquote vibrant private sector. Not to say that there aren't a lot of wonderful things going on in the private sector. There are. Science and technology. I finally was inspired with our wonderful production team to sit down today and write a little piece called Out of Control, Control. The efforts to control the population are really completely over the top. You almost don't know what words to find. I struggle to find words to communicate how just out of control it is. There was a series of different stories, and I wanted to bring them all together. We have the NSA, of course, for the last several weeks telling us that they can listen to anything we say and keep a record of it through whatever medium, and all sorts of internet and social media also do the same, and of course through the back door provided to the NSA. Now, and you'll see these stories up on the blog, we have Harvard and members of the scientific community saying that they can direct the thoughts of animals and also implant false memories in people. Now, what this means is that there's all sorts of technology to influence or insert thoughts and cause us to act in various ways, but it also means that enforcement agencies or courts can call up experts to testify that our testimony suddenly is not the case. They're false memories. Now, you think that's bad enough. Now we have DARPA slapping out contracts to simply come up with ways of inserting new chromosomes in our body and filling it up so that they can reinvent our DNA to their liking and do it not with our permission, but simply just by spraying overhead. And to think that's outrageous, I sent my little post on Out of Control, Control to John Rappaport, and he wrote back and he said, oh, DARPA is also pursuing a mind control project to detect how the brain accepts or rejects propaganda narratives of events. Now, all of this, of course, is being funded with our tax dollars, which makes it all the more amazing that we're financing literally, I just don't even know what to say about them. But check out that blog post, because it's if you ever thought that the situation wasn't out of control, there it is. The hit on the IRS continues, and if you've ever been frustrated with paying taxes, don't fall into thinking this is a good thing. When you get these kind of political efforts to really work over an agency like this, if anything, you're going to end up with an agency that's much more political You know, this is a condition that creates a lot of fear, and when that happens, lots of things, crazy things can go on, but it's one, it'll be very interesting to see where it goes. You have efforts in Congress to come up with major tax reform. Again, I certainly don't think it's going to go anywhere this year, but we'll see what happens. Wall Street's role in stockpiling commodities keeps coming up. A number of articles posted on the blog. And it's interesting that it's doing, because generally those stockpiling helps to prop up prices. Of course, commodities, another asset class completely in the doghouse. And it's interesting to see that it's happening when commodities are really at the bottom. Finally, one headline, and I just have to bring this up because to me this is one of the most shocking stories I've ever seen. Homeland Security has announced that they are building their new headquarters at the St. Elizabeth site in D.C. And I literally, I'm going to have to give you some background to describe this story. St. Elizabeth was a mental institute in Washington, and it was a mental institute that off and on has been the subject of investigative reporters pointing out that some very scary and unusual things have been going on there. One story, for example, is Kelly O'Meara's story of she studied the people who've been buried at St. Elizabeth's. You had a lot of patients who died there, didn't have families to take care of their burial arrangements. They were buried at St. Elizabeth's. And what she went into the National Archives and discovered that they all seemed to automatically die 6 months magically after they'd entered St. Elizabeth's. And she came to me and said, what could possibly explain this? And I said, what could possibly explain this is that the funding ran out from the municipal government to pay for them. And so, you know, they were disposed of. So, but the rumors of things going on at St. Elizabeth's are quite amazing. Anyway, I wanted to read a speech once attributed to Chief Seattle, and this is the end of his speech. It's one I love so much. He said, "When the last red man shall have perished, and the memory of my tribe shall have become a myth among the white men, these shores will swarm with the invisible dead of my tribe. And when your children's children think themselves alone in the field, the store, the shop, upon the highway, or in the silence of the pathless woods, they will not be alone. In all the earth there is no place dedicated to solitude. At night, when the streets of your cities and villages are silent and you think them deserted, they will throng with the returning hosts that once filled them and still love this beautiful land. The white man will never be alone. Let him be just and deal kindly with my people, for the dead are not powerless." And I would say to the Department of Homeland Security, I believe that the dead are not powerless. And if you look at who the dead at St. Elizabeth are, I find it quite remarkable. And for those of us who want decentralization, it's probably a good sign that the Department of Homeland Security will be there, because I would think it'd be a very hard place to build a successful culture. Let me just jump. Bradley Manning acquitted this week of aiding the enemy for giving secrets to WikiLeaks. That's very good news. He was found guilty on other counts, so the slugfest, the legal slugfest, continues. But I think that was a very positive development. Kudos to the judge for deciding that. Anyway, that's it for Money and Markets. Hero, a lovely story this week. Two young men on their bicycles chased down a car of somebody who'd kidnapped a 5-year-old girl. And so Timur Boggs and his friend Chris Garcia are our hero this week. It's just a really sweet little story. You can read about it. There's a video up over in the Life section. I won't bore you with the details of what would probably happen to that 5-year-old, the 5-year-old girl, but suffice it to say, it's very, very big business to kidnap kids like that and auction them off, and a very profitable business. And so kudos for Timur and Chris for running her down. And it just goes to show you what two kids on a bicycle can do if they put their mind to it. Okay, Ask Catherine. We got a whole bunch of questions this week, and I'm delighted to see that. I live in the New Jersey area, which is plagued with hurricane visits yearly. In exploring alternative power resources, I learned of cogeneration to supply electricity during power failures for extended periods. When you have a moment, I would appreciate your feedback, guidance, in suggesting resources to possibly purchase a residential 5 kW cogenerator using natural gas. Any suggestions, comment, guidance is greatly appreciated. We emailed back to this is from John. We emailed back to John some ideas from one of our subscribers who's the most knowledgeable, in fact, in this business. And believe it or not, one of the things he suggested was eBay, which I thought was interesting because I've done a lot on eBay. It's always amazing what you can do there. In preparation for this broadcast, I was listening to the previous Breakaway Civilization. Dr. Farrell had said what sparked his interest in the Nazis was the vast plunder and plan to exit Europe with said plunder. As I'm sure you're aware, the U.S. and Canadian governments both interned Japanese during World War II. My in-laws were both in internment camps as small children, one in each country. Their families lost everything. Nothing was ever recovered. About 30 years ago, Canada paid each internee $20,000 in reparations. About 25 years ago, the U.S. did the same. Does anyone know what ever happened to all that the Japanese owned? Cui bono. In our family's case, they went from being solidly middle class to penniless for decades, unable to even get jobs or find housing except of the worst sort. Having close relatives who were part of the Nisei Regiment, it was the 442nd, the most accomplished regiment in World War II history, in spite of being largely not credited for it, did not seem to make any difference at all. It's if you don't know that story, it's a remarkable story of one of many, many examples in American history of people's assets being stolen. And not to underestimate the power of many Japanese who were rounded up, or people of Japanese descent, many of them were American citizens, who were rounded up and put in the camps during World War II, an enormous amount of extremely valuable and attractive California farmland was seized because they'd been very successful in high-quality vegetables and other kinds of farming, and had very valuable land out in California. Interestingly enough, I did a paper on this in history at the University of Pennsylvania when I was in college, and it's remarkable the amount of theft and thievery and genocide that has gone on inside of our borders, if you ever sit down and study it. But this is one of the extraordinary examples of just political exploitation and theft. And asset forfeiture is one of the things that's been used to fund a lot of silly business, and it's pretty frightening, some of the things that go on. But that was from Laurie. Laurie, thank you for bringing that up. Question, are you suspicious of something behind the scenes with a train crash in Spain? The answer is yes, but it's one of those situations where you could spend a great deal of time trying to find out if anything really, you know, if it was a covert op, and unless you have inside sources, no point in doing it. So could have been an accident or not, no way to tell that I know of. I personally tend to fear that the commodities markets will break, not just the gold-silver market, but also that of oil, food-based metals. At some point, gold may no longer be redeemable for money. If this happens, then the gold commodities exchange may be canceled. The only gold for purchase may only be jewelry. Money then leaves precious metals and goes to the remaining commodities, thus driving their prices and affecting cost of living and core inflation for the public. What then will the commodities exchanges do? Cancel call and put options and force delivery? I have a hard time relating to these scenarios. In my personal experience, gold is so invaluable at the institutional level globally. I just don't see this happening. I do think that if you want to be concerned about a deflationary scenario that hurts the value of precious metals, it's one where new technology explodes out. And in that case, you see the equity markets, particularly sort of the new technology, significantly outperform gold and precious metals, and their values relatively drop, which I think is a possible scenario and one to keep an eye on. But I just don't see gold becoming irrelevant. Dear Catherine, I've followed you for many years and enjoy your articles. Recently, you were talking about the new economy separating from the old economies, and you made an unusual statement about Latin American farms poisoning the American people. What exactly did you mean by that statement, if I may ask? I'm a Latin American farmer, tomatoes, cucumbers, and I was stunned by the comment. That's from Tim. Tim, my apologies. I was speaking to, talking about the food stamp program and speaking with too broad a brush. I was referring to all the GMO food coming in from Latin America. It's also coming in from America, so I didn't mean to imply that it was only Latin America, but a lot of what's getting trucked in from Latin America is GMO, and I think GMO, from what we've seen of the evidence, is really not safe. If you're growing tomatoes and cucumbers, it certainly doesn't apply to you. Another question. My experience with the gold market is that the crazy stories come out at major turning points in the market. What do you make of the recent stories? Bank of England leased 1,300 tons of gold that wasn't there. I don't think that's necessarily a crazy story. We see the Bank of England inventories drop. That surprises me, because if you look at the recent drop in prices, I see the central banks trying to bring in a great deal of precious metals. Yeah, there are a fair amount of kooky stories going on, but if you look at the kooky stories in the gold market, they don't compare to the kooky stories in science technology, which are all true and we just talked about. So, you know, this is a kooky time. A question for Dr. Farrell. Many believe that Israel practically owns the U.S. government. However, we have Joe Biden, who is thought to be a Vatican man. The Vatican is now led by a Jesuit pope. Given that both groups are enormously influential politically and financially, please could you comment on any power play relationship between the Jesuits and Israel? Has one infiltrated the other? If you look at the last 500 years, you see a wide variety of institutions and sort of tribal networks competing and cooperating, and three that are often referred to are the Vatican, the Israeli and Jewish networks, and of course the Freemasons, and then you have all sorts of conglomerations of royalty and aristocracy and elites, various sort of groups. Rappaport, in some of his early audios, Mind Control, Mind Freedom, does a very good job of describing these, and these groups always cooperate and compete. So have they infiltrated each other? Yeah, they've been doing that for 500 years. So I would say yes, but it's very old and very organic. Another question. When you briefly spoke on Obamacare and the changes coming down the pike, it was as if you were reading my mind in regards to wondering what our choices are. My husband's and my particular health insurance plan is being discontinued as of December 31st. We just don't know what to do next and rarely see doctors or get prescriptions inside the system. I'm asking if you might consider spending a little time on this topic on a Salary Report this fall. I would love to hear an expanded version of things you mentioned, AAA and the options in private funds, where participants pool their money for the purposes you mentioned regarding potential medical costs. Great question. I can't tell you how many times on our roundups and our strategic planning meetings the Salary team has spent trying to figure out how we could do one or a series of Salary reports on what our healthcare options are. Part of it is we've been searching for somebody who could explain Obamacare in an hour or less, which is quite a struggle. And of course, watching the evolution of what's happening with Obamacare is part of this, because it can go in different ways, and so the number of potential scenarios are great. I did mention earlier on a Salary report that I do get extra coverage through AAA for car accidents. I drive a lot, so obviously it's important to have health care insurance for car accidents and transportation accidents, which is the one time I'm likely to use the sort of traditional medical establishment is under a situation where you have trauma, so something like a car accident. I am a member of Samaritan Ministries, which is a cooperative group of Christians who underwrite each other, and it's a remarkable organization, remarkable group. It's limited to Christians, but if you would qualify, I would definitely check out Samaritan Ministries. And then It was this subscriber who suggested that we have a subscriber lunch while we're in Boulder in October. Great idea. So that's what we'll do. Interview. We posted this afternoon my interview with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and there's two parts in the background on this interview, which is a very important one. First, we did an interview last year on the breakaway civilization. This one is Breakaway Civilization Part 2, but I was so inspired by my first conversation with Dr. Farrell last year that on my way back from California, I stopped to talk with him and one of his co-authors, Scott DeHart. Both of them were at Oxford. Both of them are incredible scholars and amazing in the depth of their research and interest in the world. These are two intellectually very curious people. And we had dinner and talked for about 5 hours one Saturday evening, and then the next day I came back and we systematically talked about many of the issues we talk about in this interview for another 5 hours. And I left California very inspired. That was in the end of June. And one of the reasons I felt so inspired is I pride myself on seeing the big shifts coming. And I did a very good job of anticipating what was happening with the financial coup d'etat and encouraging people to take steps, including with gold and silver, to protect themselves. And then I saw the 2008 coming and was able to encourage people to step aside in the stock market and in most risk assets. But I didn't see the fall coming in April in precious metals, and that was really disturbing me. And I felt as though my map needed a much stronger infusion of information about what's really going on and where things are going and what that means to the economy and what it means to the economy both globally and here in North America. And so and in those 10 hours, I left California saying, okay, I think I have it. And then I drove back across the country and watched how the economy was performing in the agricultural areas, in the oil and gas areas, and then in the areas which are building up the new high-tech manufacturing that we talk about in this interview. And I really felt like, okay, I have a very good framework for this next period. And so that's to be tested, and there's a lot to be filled in. So I went back after recording in 5 hours in California. I said, well, we can't do this. We can't put up 5 hours. So I called Joseph back and said, okay, can we do a summary, executive summary interview for 2 hours? And that's what we did. And we cover a lot of the questions of this division we watch going on in the economy between, you know, the legacy systems with the retirement and healthcare liabilities and a new breakaway civilization that is going gangbusters and is very, very resource rich. What is this all about? What does it mean to the economy? Where is this going? And so, and of course, what does it mean to us and what can we do about it? And so we've posted that today. It's the kind of thing if you can download and listen to if you've got a long drive. I would really encourage you to do so. It also dovetails with interviews that I did with German reporter Lars Scholl, who did for Matterhorn. Matterhorn put it up today. We'll have a link up on the blog, and then a video with USA Watchdog Greg Hunter on the same topic. He keeps having people on USA Watchdog who are saying the economy is going to collapse tomorrow. And, of course, that's just not what I believe. I think we're in for more slow burn. And that's not to say that the part of the economy, depending on the legacy systems, isn't going through a collapse. It is. But I would say it's a very controlled, I would say it's a controlled demolition more than a collapse. Okay, let's go to the movies. I chose for Let's Go to the Movies this week two documentary series originally done for television that are very useful in helping you understand what is happening in the North American economy right now. The first one is called The Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, and it was produced by the BBC. And it is the story of seven remarkable engineering or infrastructure projects that were financed. Most of them are 19th century. The Hoover Dam is 20th century. But it gives you a sense of the power and importance of major engineering feats to the development of the economy, the development of places, and the development geopolitically of different sovereign governments and empires. The second one is called Engineering and Empire, which is much longer. It was produced by the History Channel. It's not of the same quality of Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, but it does a very good job of marching you through the relationship between major in engineering and infrastructure and the development of different empires throughout the ages. And part of what you're seeing now in North America with the sort of building of a high, a distributed manufacturing capability that is taking advantage of a series of different developments. One in robotics, one in fabrication technology. 3D printing is one of the more commonly known developments in fabrication, and one in material sciences. And when you take these three together, you're talking about an absolute revolution in manufacturing, and you combine it with what is being also done in parallel in the in energy and domestic greater domestic provision of oil and gas and renewable energy, and what's being done in agriculture. And you are coming into the building of a whole new infrastructure. Now, we have yet to see exactly how all this is going to unfold, but we see many of the bits and pieces of it. And when you look at what's being developed here, it's very helpful, I think, to go back and look at how empires have grappled with building these kinds of infrastructures and building the kind of manufacturing they need to accomplish their purpose. And Dr. Farrell and I talk a little bit and speculate a little bit about what that purpose may be. I think some of that purpose is going to the next stage of the privatized effort to really build out into space. We see Silicon Valley entrepreneurs talking about mining asteroids, and if you look at what's happening in the mining industry on planet Earth, actually it makes a lot more sense than you might think. The other reason I wanted to recommend these to you, particularly Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, is that I think one of the most unfortunate aspects of the one-way mirror and so much secrecy around the black budget is that the great feats of engineering and many of the greatest inventions and accomplishments that are going on this planet are secret. And so we don't get to celebrate them. We don't get to be proud of them. I'll never forget in the early days of the space program when we put a man on the moon or when we would accomplish various things in the NASA program, you really felt the pride of being part of something that was another step forward in the development of the human, of the human civilization. And we don't get that sense of pride these days. In the Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, there is one story of the seven that is by far my favorite. And it's the story of Robert Stevenson, grandfather of Robert Louis Stevenson, who most people know, the author, who sort of invented and persuaded and for the commitments to be made to build the Bell Rock Lighthouse in Scotland. And I think he led the effort starting the year after literally 70 ships had floundered or crashed on the Bell Rock. And it's an absolutely remarkable story of the power of intellect and the power of vision and the power of the kind of imagination that John Rappaport talks about and of what one person can do to literally make an extraordinary and dramatic contribution to the human race and to the economy, because imagine all the businesses and how much money and lives are lost when 70 ships get shipwrecked, and that's only in, I think it was, that was only in 1 year. So we're talking about a world where one engineer can literally envision and implement a project, and it can make an enormous difference to countless lives, countless families, a country, and many, many businesses. And I would love to see us live in that world again, where we could envision doing that, and where we could have alignment between communities and people and businesses sufficient that not only can we do those things, but we can be inspired by them, and we can celebrate them as a society. So I found it extraordinarily inspiring to watch, and I would just pray that we take the time to understand and celebrate some of those accomplishments today, because they're certainly happening, but we don't see them and we don't celebrate them in the way I think that we once did. So if you feel like doing it, I would check these out, particularly Seven Wonders of the Industrial World from the BBC. Okay, well, that's it for this week. In closing, we have some very exciting Solaria reports coming up, and I just want to take a minute and tell you about them. August 8th, we have Open Source Ecology with Marcin Jakubowski, who's the head of he's the head of Open Source Ecology, who is designing what's called the Global Village Construction Set, open source blueprints for the 50 machines and tools you need to invent, build, and operate a civilization without having to be dependent on Mr. Global. It was such a remarkable conversation that after we finished doing the Solaria report, we just kept recording, and I gave him a little briefing on the MIT Project Management System, which we'll also post up. And I ended up participating in the design sprint that Marcin has. He and OSE do a design sprint every week or two. And everybody gets online and starts designing tractors and permafracture curriculum and all sorts of other stuff. So he's somebody who's really doing a remarkable thing to help build a decentralized economy. And I think he's going to receive a lot of support from the powers that be, because if you're trying to build a decentralized manufacturing infrastructure, you certainly want it to be fashionable. And you certainly want lots of young people getting in there and learning how to make things, because, again, you're going to go to something far more distributed. So I think there's a very interesting alignment happening between all the innovators in the military. You want to bring the price of a jet fighter way, way down, if not make a spaceship more economically feasible, and what Marcin is doing to help communities rebuild. August 13th, Coming Clean, Transforming Lives Through the Power of Cleaning. I'm a person who's extraordinarily interested in cleaning, and one of the reasons is Eunice Boston, who runs a remarkable company called Partners in Grime, is a very dear friend of mine and taught me about cleaning. And when I started Hamilton Securities in Washington, I insisted that Eunice start a subsidiary in Washington and hire up and become the cleaning company for Hamilton Securities. And it was that decision that saved my life. And I'm going to tell you the story of how Eunice Boston and her cleaning team, in fact, saved my life. Just remember, when you walk out the door of your business every night, you leave behind incredible information and value in the computers, in the files. So you just do not want anybody in the cleaning company to come in. And so the Partners in Grime story is a very interesting one. Then August 20th, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, back for the second time on the Solaria Report. We'll be talking about the strategic issues facing the U.S. military. If our entire economy depends on the value of the dollar, and the dollar being the reserve currency, and the dollar being the reserve currency because we control the sea lanes and the satellite lanes and have the most powerful military in the world, it pays to understand what's happening in the military. Wilkerson is the visiting professor at the College of William and Mary, teaching courses on U.S. national security, but of course, he was the chief of staff to Colin Powell and has been the man who's been most forceful in calling Dick Cheney a liar, which takes a lot of courage. So Wilkerson is a remarkable man, and so we're delighted to have him back. Okay, so until next week with March and Jakubowski on the Global Village Construction Set and Open Source Ecology, please remember, don't worry about whether there or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce again Dr. Joseph Farrell to the Soleri Report. Dr. Farrell needs no introduction. If you haven't listened to the first interview we did on the breakaway civilization, that was part one. This is going to be part two. I'm going to ask Dr. Farrell to walk through his website and books and materials so that we can get a detailed understanding. But his website is GizaDeathStar.com, and there is a wealth of information. And so without further ado, Dr. Farrell, welcome to the Soleri Report. I should say, welcome back to the Soleri Report.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me back on. I appreciate it.
Well, on my way back from California, I had the opportunity to stop and talk with you. We had dinner and then a long conversation the next day with you, dinner with you and your co-author, Dr. Scott DeHart. And I have to tell you, it is a very rare experience for me to leave a conversation that enthused. Usually it has to be a great sermon. But I left California. I left your, that discussion thinking, well, I really can understand my world. I really can. I'm not alone. There are brilliant minds out there. I can understand my world. And so I'm really pleased that we could do this today because I learned so much and there's so much
we
have to
too.
Talk about. Yeah. And I learned about that Dr. Pepper type soda, which I'd never...
Mr. Bibb.
Mr. Bibb, I hadn't known about Mr. Bibb. That was a new one for me. Okay, well, I just wanted to start this evening by recapping a little bit of what we did in part one, and I really encourage our listeners, if you haven't heard that, I would stop right now, go listen to that, because we walked through some of the history of the threads that come together into what's called the breakaway civilization. We walk through the history of the Nazis and how they wove into the national security, the creation of the national security infrastructure, and then the financing of the black budget and how that evolved along with, in fact, the narcotics trafficking lines and how it all came together. And we kind of ended with alluding to how it sort of came together in what I call the financial coup d'etat and bailouts, where I wanted to pick up and start today. But why don't you introduce the concept of the breakaway civilization and make sure in this part you describe the different books and other materials you have available for people who want to know more.
Well, the idea of a breakaway civilization, Catherine, isn't mine. It's actually Richard M. Dolan, who is, in my opinion, he's probably the most academic and scholarly person investigating UFOs out there. He's written a couple of wonderful books called UFOs and the National Security State. And for people that don't know his work, Mr. Dolan is actually an academically trained historian. So his books aren't the usual sort of, I saw glowing lights on such and such a day, or I was abducted by gray aliens. What he actually does is he goes in and examines UFO documents from different governments and so on and so forth. And his argument essentially is that you cannot understand the growth of the American national security state without understanding that at its very core there is a huge preoccupation, a huge obsession almost, with the UFO subject, and all the secrecy that spins out from that has really affected the culture of the national security state. Now, the other component in his thinking here is that if UFOs represent a kind of a nuts and bolts technology, and in my opinion, I don't think you can come away from reading a vast amount of UFO reports and come to any other conclusion. Not all of them are, certainly, but some of them are. And his thinking here is that in the investigation of that kind of technology, over time and with enough money, it's very conceivable that the national security state acquired technologies so far in advance of what's publicly available that it would constitute almost a breakaway civilization, something completely different with its very own culture of decision-making and policy formation based on that technological superiority. So it's a very intriguing idea. And one of the things that you and I discussed when you were here with Dr. DeHart is the idea that, okay, if we have a breakaway civilization, then this is going to require some mechanism of finance. And this is really largely what I've discussed in a few books that I've authored recently, one of them being a book called The Nazi International, which I go into the post-war survival and machinations of the Nazis. And the other two are a book called Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops, which I think we talked about a little bit in the previous interview, and another book called Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations. I just completed a third book, which should be out in the next couple of months, called Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, which kind of picks up on all these threads. But in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, which we discussed extensively in the last interview, we were talking about the idea, all right, well, if we're going to fund a national security apparatus that has simultaneously to deal with the threat of international communism and eventually to roll it back, and with the problem of the UFO, whatever or whoever it may represent, then we're going to have a vast system of finance. But the problem is, when you're dealing with these kinds of threats, that system of finance has to be more or less totally free of government oversight. So I've hypothesized that the bearer bond scandals, some of the related derivatives bubbles and scandals that we saw during the bailout period really represent the signatures of a completely hidden system of finance that was put into place utilizing all of that Axis plunder from World War II and laundered through Western banks. I think this is the root of the problem.
Right, I would also say, from what I saw at the Federal Housing Administration, that you're talking about a system that operates through the New York Fed, through the Treasury, through the Department of Justice, and is using government accounts to engage in massive mortgage fraud and money laundering.
Oh yes, absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind. I think in terms of the financial aspects of this, Catherine, one of the things that you mentioned during our conversations out here, and it has, like with you, it has stayed with me since that conversation, and that is the idea of material omission. That, you know, when you're drawing up a prospectus for various investors in a firm or various projects or inventions, you have to make sure you disclose everything. Well, the whole idea of a breakaway civilization with a hidden system of finance is a huge, gigantic material omission. And in that material omission, like you say, we're dealing, I think, on at least 3 to 4 levels. We've got mortgage and securities fraud. We have drug trade, drug money being laundered. And in that respect, it's important for people to recall that when you read in some of these hidden systems of finance or papers dealing with them, the term gold doesn't necessarily refer to bullion. It refers to drugs.
Right.
And so we're dealing with the drug trade. And then at a third level, and this is the level that kind of intrigued me the most, was with all of the massive amount of bullion that the Japanese plundered from Asia during World War II, this was rolled over at the end of the war by the Truman administration into a completely hidden, off-the-books political slush fund. In other words, yeah, this Truman took the decision to recover this bullion, and that meant, to a certain extent, as I argue, the Truman administration made dirty deals with the Japanese because they knew where all of it really was. So all of this bullion is rolled into this hidden political slush fund. It's kept top secret. And this, in turn, you mentioned the New York Federal Reserve, and I think you're absolutely right there for any number of reasons. And the first being that it would have been that particular Federal Reserve branch that would have been the focus or nexus for storing that bullion and then rehypothecating it over and over and creating a huge system of financial leverage. So in other words, they've created a huge system of hidden finance, a black budget that's literally draining and controlling every other aspect of the federal budget.
Well, it's doing more than that because it's controlling every aspect of the federal budget, but it's also controlling the financial aspects of places. You mentioned a couple places where they had these big pools. I'd like to add another one. Throughout our society, particularly state and local government, you have enormous pools of escrowed monies. So you have bond reserve funds, you have pension funds, you have enormous reserves. And the funny business going on behind the scenes in and around those reserves is part of that. And then you have the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which when you are the big New York Fed member banks, who are the depository for the federal government, so they control and manage the federal government accounts, not the federal government. And when they have the authority to intervene broadly in the market using slush fund monies and levering it with, you know, the ability to stuff and pull out of these various pools of capital, you know, now you're talking into the, you know, meta-trillions of dollars in what can be levered and engineered.
Well, and there's something else that we discussed when you were out here as well, and I think that should be mentioned too. And that's the financial implications of the NSA spying.
Right.
Because with that kind of computational power, I read an article recently, Catherine, where this facility they're building allegedly in Utah, and I think quite frankly that that facility is probably a Potemkin village because they're not going to put everything on the surface.
But, no kidding.
You know, it's an easy, nice target. But but I read a figure where the data storage that they would have available there would be 5 zettabytes. And a zettabyte is 1 billion terabytes. So in other words, they're creating a facility to store enough data from electronic communications data mining for the next 100 years.
Right.
Now, if you've got that kind of computational power, the other thing that we discussed was this would be the perfect insider trading mechanism. You could use that ability to tap into any electronic transfer of funds, any electronic transaction, in other words, delay it by a few nanoseconds if you had to, and in the process of delaying, use that money for something else and then allow the transaction to go through and skim off your take. So in other words, you're creating yet again another system on top of everything else that we've discussed. And when you add the possibilities of high-frequency trading that this would give you, of algorithmic trading, you know, the potential here is enormous. So the black budget, I think, is, as you say, it's controlling all of this, and that is a huge amount of money. And the question we have to ask goes right back directly to Dolan. That amount of money would be capable of creating enormous technological advances.
Yeah, including space fleets.
Exactly.
So you could build and run and operate a secret space program.
Absolutely. And that's more or less the subject of the three books, Saucer, Swastikas, and Psyops, and Covert Wars, and Breakaway Civilizations, and then the one I just finished, covert wars and the clash of civilizations. Because, you know, most people looking at this hidden system of finance, Catherine, are thinking in terms that it was simply used as a slush fund for covert psychological operations or what have you here on planet Earth. But I just don't see the numbers adding up if you look at it that way, because
right.
those kinds of operations are simply not going to cost that much money. And as you say, there's so much leverage in this system, in the metatrillions of dollars, if not quadrillions of dollars, then this money is going somewhere. And I've tried to explore some of the possibilities in the last two books I mentioned as to what they might be. And as you say, you end up coming to the conclusion, well, this has to be for something, and most likely it's off-planet.
Right, right. Or, you know, including in that all the, I don't know if you've ever spent a lot of time studying the research and reports on underground facilities, including underground railroads.
Oh, yes.
But I think that's related.
Oh, yes, I absolutely agree with you there. In fact, in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, I talk a bit about the research of a gentleman by the name of Richard Sauter, who's written a number of very interesting, very detailed books exploring the actual technologies that exist for creating enormous underground structures and doing so relatively efficiently. And also, you know, I was reading just this last week, Catherine, about new technologies for rail transport that are being developed in this country. You know, maglev was invented
right.
in the United States, and we're still lumbering along on Amtrak at 55 miles an hour.
Well, above ground, but below ground.
Above ground, exactly. But below ground, exactly. And I do think that you're quite right. That amount of money would create an enormous underground infrastructure. And that infrastructure itself, in my opinion, as I argued in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, is another indicator that you're dealing with a completely breakaway civilization with its own infrastructure, its own institutions, its own facilities, and so on.
I used to see, I think I told the story the last time, of when the HUD secretary kind of had a temper tantrum and flipped out at one of the regional administrators and said, you know, I don't have to obey the law. I report to a higher moral authority. And he just went off, and you realized you suddenly had an image of an Eyes Wide Shut scene.
Right.
With the secret society
right.
wearing Venetian masks and realizing, you know, that's who he reported to, and he thought all this stuff about the laws was hooey. He didn't need to be, you know, they just, so you're talking about, you know, a level of power that can act above the law with impunity and kind of sees that as sort of quaint stuff that they don't need to be bothered with, and they really don't.
Oh, yes, and I totally agree with that analysis, and here's why. We have to go back to the fact that the culture of this breakaway civilization is being formed in the matrix of the Cold War. So in other words, when you read about the machinations and doings of people like Alan Dulles or Richard Bissell, you know, all of these people at the CIA, or Frank Wisner at the Office of Policy Coordination, or even more recently with what we've seen with the NSA, what comes through time and again is the fact that they are willing and able to do almost anything in the name of national security, which oftentimes translates to being in the name of the preservation of their power and their particular bureaucratic fiefdom. So, yes, I think that absolutely nails it right there, what you just said.
So, but I do want to say in their defense, once you've made an institutional commitment to secrecy,
right.
And then once you're committed to financing not only whatever you have to finance behind that secrecy,
right.
but you have to continue to operate the dollar reserve system and financing sort of the U.S. machinery, including a whole lot of citizens who want to live in a non-sustainable way, you know, you are in a double bind.
Yeah, and I really have to agree with you there. We are witnessing the partial exposure, I think, of this financial system, not because they've chosen to, but because in a certain sense events have overtaken them, and they now have a form of competition geopolitically that they didn't have during the Cold War. The Cold War was uniquely clarifying in one sense because we really only had one particular geopolitical enemy. now we are faced with, you know, the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and within each of those nations their own factions, but there's certainly some pushback from them and even from Europe.
Right.
So it's not the nice, tidy, bipolar world that they were living in the early days when this culture was being formed. So some of it is leaking out. I do suspect that there is tremendous factional infighting going on within this group. We talked about that a little bit the last time, and I think some of it's coming to fore. And I think there's also, you know, the player here that we have to look at very carefully are Japan and China.
Right.
Because these were the two nations involved in that vast bullion plunder in Asia during World War II. So it's those two nations, in addition to whoever's behind the creation of this secret system of finance, that know good and well how much gold there really was. And that's another huge part of this story I think we need to mention.
Right.
Because, you know, we're seeing now the gold market just kind of behaving irrationally. It was going up in kind of a bubble, and it was deliberately taken down during the Boston Marathon bombing. Now there's stories that, you know, the gold is being shipped to China, it's being melted down and recast for the People's Bank of China, and so on. Well, for me, Catherine, the real problem here is much more fundamental, and especially if you're thinking of investing in precious metals as part of your investment portfolio. The real problem for me has been, first of all, you have it as a matter of policy on the part of Western central banks that they do not ever completely tell the truth about how much gold that they have, simply as a matter of national security. In other words, they're going to give you a ballpark figure, but they're never going to give you an exact figure because that is a matter of national security for each of those nations. But the real problem here, Catherine, is when you add into this mix the fact that all of that Japanese bullion plunder at the end of World War II became the basis, the secret basis, for this hidden system of finance, then what it means is you have yet another layer of obfuscation on the amounts of gold in existence. And in my opinion, I'll be very honest, my gut intuition, Catherine, is that the amounts of gold that you can go out there and research and get estimates on how much they think may be in existence, in my opinion, that amount may be off by as much as an order of magnitude. So,
and what's interesting is if you look at mortgages or treasury bonds, I think it's many, many orders of magnitude. But
if you
look at gold, though, and, you know, we'll get into this later, I'm skipping way ahead.
Uh-huh.
One of the issues is the trade in gold planetary, or is it more than planetary?
Well, yeah.
And that makes the idea of trying to estimate how much gold there is or is not
even harder. Well, you know, since you brought the subject up, let's look at that, because one of the theses I try and develop in the book I just finished is precisely that, all right, we have indications, and I talk about it in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, we have indications that emerge from this hidden system of finance in the bearer bonds scandals that suggest that space itself, outer space itself, was collateralized very early on as a component of this hidden system of finance. So in other words, what I'm suggesting is that they created a huge system of leverage for the express purpose of creating the technologies, the space fleets, as you say, to go out there, and whatever they find there would be the basis of collateralizing or backing, if you will, all of this vast system of funding that they've created. So
that makes sense. They've sold licenses to the Wild West.
Exactly. Right. In other words, it's kind of a space version of the Republic of Venice, because what you're asking these bankers that are involved in this system to do is float enormous amounts of loans and things of this sort And in return, you're giving them a stake on whatever you find with your fleets that you're building in the state arsenal in Venice.
So, when all these Silicon Valley entrepreneurs talk about space mining and going to Mars, they're just talking their book, right?
Yeah, exactly. Bingo. You know, and I find it very interesting. You know, what really amazed me, Catherine, is almost, I would say no longer than 6 months after Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations came out, where I first suggested this idea, the public press is starting to talk very openly about asteroid mining. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the big thing now is NASA wants to go out and grab small asteroids from near Earth orbit and haul them to the moon, you know, and you just have to stop and think about what they're really saying here. Haul them to the moon, park them in orbit around the moon, and mine them, okay? Now, the fact of the matter is, you know, rockets are just horribly impractical and cost-ineffective way of doing this. So the mere fact that they're suggesting these things, and you know, at one time there was even talk about a mission to an asteroid, landing on an asteroid, so that we could learn how to do this and do so for the express purpose of mining it. Well, the asteroid belt is a huge, huge wealth of mineral and other types of resources. So in other words, I think they already collateralized space. I think that probably these stories are their way of admitting that they have other technologies that are off the books that we don't know about that are enabling them to talk openly about mining asteroids. But in all honesty, Catherine, we can forget about rockets to do this. It's just, you know, it's just not cost effective.
Yet. Yes.
Yet.
So let me jump back, because I want to go back and tie back to history. We had, you know, in the last time we'd come up to the financial coup d'etat, but let me take us back to 1994, because a decision was made in the early 90s to rebalance the whole economy globally.
Right.
So a decision was made. Now, I would like to point out, nobody reinvests money. So a huge amount of money was taken out of the developed world, out of G7, and reinvested into the G20 and the frontier market. So now, nobody ever puts investment into, you know, if you read the history of the United States, London is investing money into Texas land, but Pinkerton is right, you know, right behind to make sure you can enforce.
Right.
So we're moving. I think that very much paralleled the launch and the management. It was Lockheed who was doing it, the system of satellites globally.
Yes.
So, and then you shift the army and special forces globally, and then you've got the capacity to enforce, so you can shift the money.
Right, exactly.
So there was something having to do, and I wonder, you explored a lot of the secret technology and secret weaponry in mm-hmm. your most recent book. I'm wondering if it was that technology that said, okay, we can reinvest globally because now at fairly low cost, you know, either to us or we can put it to the taxpayers, we can enforce our investment globally in a whole new way.
Oh, yes, absolutely I do. Absolutely I do. And the reason why is, you know, we all know about the public technologies and some of the publicly available documents behind those technologies like HARP and some of the things that were first talked about in terms of the military capabilities of HARP as a defense shield and so on, as a weather manipulator and so on and so forth. These are all right there in the original Eastland patents that led to the development of that technology. And for that matter, you can find various researchers in the alternative community like Lieutenant Colonel Tom Bearden, who maintained for years that the Soviet Union had been developing a similar technology, and certainly Europe, principally Germany, has that technology with ISCAT and so on and so forth. So yes, I think those technologies definitely exist, that they were put into place precisely, as you say, for enforcement purposes. And it's important here to mention something else, I think, Catherine, what we're really talking about. These kinds of technologies are technologies that are based and utilize the electrodynamic properties of the entire planet. So in other words, you're dealing in a certain sense, Catherine, with what the Russian astronomer Kardashev classified as a class one civilization. And let me quickly explain what these things are. He basically developed an idea of three classes of civilization. A class one civilization was a civilization whose energy requirements required the energy output of an entire planet. A class two civilization was a civilization that required the energy output of an entire star. And a class three civilization was a civilization that required the output of an entire galaxy. Now, I have what I call the feral corollaries. and the corollaries are even more interesting, because the corollaries are that you get to the point of becoming a class one civilization when you acquire the technologies that can manipulate the systems on that scale. So in other words, the corollary here is we are on the cusp of becoming a class one civilization with technologies like HARP, because these technologies are reliant upon the entire electrodynamic properties of the entire planet. So in other words, if you now turn that kind of inside out and think what that spells in terms of the military capability that you're dealing with, or the potential that you're dealing with, then you're dealing with technologies, really, Catherine, that make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker, because
right.
Now you're able to manipulate systems on a regional or even continental, or even if you want to go that far, a planetary basis.
And you can do it without people understanding that you're doing it.
And that's the other wonderful thing. And I'm so glad you mentioned that, because this takes us back to that culture of the breakaway civilization and how it forms in the Cold War matrix. And one of the things I've stressed in all three of these books is that part of this culture is plausible deniability.
Right.
And, you know, what's easier to deny than an act of God or an act of nature? You know, if you're manipulating the weather, most people don't even think that humanity has come anywhere close to the ability to do this. I'm one of those that thinks the exact opposite. I think that they have developed the capability and fine-tuned it to a great pitch. So, you know, it's plausible deniability. And the other thing that we need to mention here in terms of investment is, you know, they're talking about weather derivatives. Well, what a wonderful thing to have around, you know, if you're actually creating securities
right.
and investments based on weather,
right.
you can
and
manipulate.
That takes us back to the NSA insider trading machine.
Exactly.
You are creating economic phenomena.
Right.
You're inventing, you're creating it, so you're inventing what's going on in the material world, and then you're
exactly.
trading it, and you can manipulate everybody on both sides of the balance sheet as you're doing it.
Yep.
And the profiteering is extraordinary.
And the avenues and mechanisms for profiteering in that kind of scenario are just enormous. So, you know, they're creating leverage upon leverage with these advanced technologies. And, you know, this is something that I hope people are latching onto, is the linkage between advanced physics and the technologies that implies, and then advanced systems of leverage and finance, because these two things work in tandem, and I think they've worked deliberately in tandem since the end of World War II and the establishment of this whole system of finance. Absolutely.
And it's more than just trading something. You're talking about the creation of markets, the creation of economy.
Yes.
You're talking about, you know, I keep referring back to Isaac Asimov's The Foundation.
Oh, yes.
You're talking about the computational capacity to invent and engineer everything.
Yes, absolutely. The other part of this mechanism that, you know, the Foundation trilogies bring up, actually it's more than just a trilogy. He wrote several sequels and prequels to it. But when you sit down and read those things, what Asimov is really talking about is not only the computational ability, but the mathematical theory to be able to model complete complex systems of human interactions of almost any type.
Right.
And, you know, this was very, very prophetic, because recently I ran across an article that was talking precisely about these types of computer modeling gaming systems that they now have. And one of them, believe it or not, is called the World Sentient Program. So, you know, that conjures all sorts of apocalyptic images. But you know, the ability that this would give them to plan for any sort of scenario or response, or to game out long-term strategic economic initiatives and so on, such as you've suggested with the 1994 decisions, this is an enormous capability.
I was having dinner once with a group called Global Business Network, and I was sitting next to an insurance executive from Scandinavia, and he started to tell me about the research they had been doing on the fact that memories come from the future.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you've ever worked at all with Cliff High's WebBot program.
Oh, I've heard of it, yes.
What he did is he built WebBots that could map sort of what people were talking about in many different languages and synthesize it, and then he would synthesize it into reports of what people were anticipating. And, it's inconceivable to me that part of what the NSA is doing, you know, I think what they're doing is they're not just doing insider trading or collecting information intelligence. They're literally trying to map the psychic storm in
yes.
a way that dynamically lets them steer the psychic storm, just like they're steering the weather. You know,
yes,
hurricane, you're steering the psychic storm.
Oh, yes, I absolutely agree with that. The reason why is there is a branch of linguistics called psycholinguistics, pardon me, and sociolinguistics, and this is precisely what it deals with, is the types of patterns that emerge by looking at certain words or certain morphemes or phonemes and what have you, and how often they recur. So, you know, with that kind of computational ability, yes, they would be able to game out scenarios and then, as you say, manipulate or weather the psychic storm, so to speak.
Right.
So, yeah, absolutely. You know, this is that culture of full spectrum dominance that I talked about in Breakaway Civilizations, that is coming home to roost. And, you know, the real problem that they have, Catherine, and it's the same old problem. You can game out statistically the types of responses, but the problem is always, always, always going to be either the unique individual human being, if you're a sociologist or a government planner, or if you're a physicist, it's going to be a unique individual particle, you know, so on and so forth. But it's always, always the same problem.
Right. It's the divine intelligence.
It's exactly, precisely.
Well, I want to come back to the concept of material emission, because
okay.
you're talking about a gigantic secret system.
Yes.
You know, a whole world that's behind what Glenn Greenwald calls the one-way mirror.
Yes.
But if you look at that system, it depends on the nuts and bolts of money going from the right to the left. Ultimately,
yes.
you have to come back to financial transactions.
Right.
And financial transactions that parallel things that go on in the real world. So, you know, somebody ships cucumbers from here to there.
Right.
And that's why I'm such a nut about not engaging in material emissions about those things.
Oh, same here.
Because that's the part you can't, you know, that can unsecret the whole thing.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
I want to go back to 9/11, because 9/11 was the time, up until 9/11, I was interacting with a variety of different groups and people and reporters and radio show hosts who are trying to illuminate the corruption. Now, to a certain extent, I think corruption is just a cover story for a much deeper thing.
Yes.
And I kept saying, look, we have to look at the black budget, and we have to look at UFOs, and we have to look at all this stuff. And everybody would say, oh, no, that's not socially acceptable. Wait a minute. You know, it's big money. And finally I came to the conclusion that the entire financial system was a harvesting system that was feeding the black budget. And you had these stories like you had in Arkansas during the Clinton's reign where a soccer mom would, you know, wake up one day to find her child dead, and it was because of narcotics trafficking. She would try and figure out what happened, and the next thing you know, she had James Bond and black helicopters and the entire national security state coming down on her head. And you think, you know, why do they care about this one soccer mom in Arkansas?
Right.
And you finally come to realize that you have 3,100 counties and a highly centralized harvesting system, and they can't afford for one county to get out of the trap.
That's right.
Because then every county could get out of the trap. And there is a direct, you know, so soccer mom is feeding Tony Soprano, who's feeding James Bond, who's feeding, you know, Star Trek.
Yes.
and there's like, you know, there's no degrees of separation. It's just like one, two, three.
Yep.
And it doesn't take but, you know, a tiny drop in revenues and profits to bring, you know, Star Trek and James Bond down on soccer mom's head.
That's right.
So my feeling was, look, if you look at how the money works, we cannot afford a material omission in this area.
That's
we
right.
We have to deal with this.
Absolutely.
And one of the reasons I thought it was so important was my big question on 9/11 was 9/11 a way of migrating a lot of the black budget on budget and changing the budget and finance rules so you could do a lot of this without creating criminal liability? Because the amount of criminal liability was unbearable given the fighting and competition between people.
Oh, I absolutely think that you're on to something there, and for several reasons. You know as well as I do that there were financial aspects to 9/11 that were being investigated that were called off as a result of that.
Right.
But the other thing that I think has happened, looking back on it, you know, we have the retrospective now of over a decade, and looking back on it, the other thing that I think is interesting to see occurring is there appears to have been a shift in the long-term policy of the Anglo-American Western financial oligarchy. Because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think you saw this big push to try and turn the world into one big unipolar Pax Americana, and that has failed.
Right.
And I think what is happening, and this is something that we all discussed when you were visiting, I think what's happening is that they have taken a long-term strategic decision to secure their power base, which obviously is North America, to a lesser extent Western Europe. But I think they've taken a decision to secure their power base. And Japan, incidentally. I would throw Japan in there because of Fukushima, which I think was definitely a shot across the Japanese bows by these people. And the other part of this, the other component of this, I think, Catherine, is that they have, and this, again, I think that when we were discussing this, you pointed out that all of a sudden now we have the appearance of 3D printing.
Right.
And this big push for 3D printing. And I think the consensus was, when we were discussing this, that this was clearly a technology that had originated within the Black Project's world. And certain aspects of it were being released into the public precisely for the purpose of returning manufacturing to North America. You can't have your grand Venetian space empire if you don't have any manufacturing. So this, you know, this is a component of it, and it's also a way of retrenching their power base. So I think you're absolutely right. In these circumstances, they have to make some of this vast system of financial leverage that's there, as you pointed out. There's all of this vast amount of money tied up in escrow. Well, one of the things, Catherine, I noticed recently was the SEC apparently is intending to dramatically relax its rules on crowd financing of investments and entrepreneurs, startups. So, hello?
Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah. I thought we clicked and may have gotten cut off.
No. To me, there are three prongs going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw it starting with the development of the oil and gas.
Mm-hmm.
We started after 9/11 to dramatically build out the domestic oil and gas reserves,
right,
bringing the price of gas down to literally make the cost of energy, a very small percent of what it would be in China.
Right.
So the competitive advantage on oil and gas is tremendous. So that's number one. And in North America, 40% of the cost of manufacturing comes from energy. It's a bigger component than labor.
Right.
Even now. So then the second thing was letting the technology, so we're seeing new fabrication technology like the 3D printing. We're seeing new material sciences technology.
Yes.
And we're seeing new robotics. And,
oh, yes.
And all of this stuff is very dazzling, particularly when you think about what could happen in combination. And then the third thing now with the Jobs Act, we're seeing a loosening of the, number one, the ability to solicit through the internet or, basically solicit strangers, including non-accredited strangers.
Right.
And what that means is, the same principles that have always applied to the lottery now apply to, raising equity capital, including startup capital. But when you look at how this could work, and we'll go into it later on, but you can literally receive a solicitation by email that comes along with entrainment technology.
Yep.
You can click on your email and click your Google wallet and send back money and buy stock, with less clicks than it takes to buy your book at Amazon.
Yep.
And so you combine the energy with the technology with the change in the startup financing, and you're talking about a renaissance in manufacturing, which is quite extraordinary. And it's going to come into a place, if you go into the old Rust Belt and you look at what's being done to basically strip the unions away.
Yep.
And bring in things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and create essentially, my guess is where they're going is they want corporate municipal entities.
I absolutely agree with all of this.
Right.
I think you're dead on. I think you're dead spot on.
Right.
I think this is exactly what they're doing.
Well, let me mention one other thing or a couple other things on the stalling of globalization, and then we'll come back to this sort of what's
uh-huh.
about to explode upon us in North America. Because I remember driving out from, I saw it when we were talking, suddenly it all came together, all the different patterns, and I thought, oh my God, I see what the next phase is going to be, the sort of new, post-industrial or digital manufacturing revolution. And I was shaking my head. I was kind of seeing stars. But one of the things I've been very interested in this process post 9/11 of sort of globalizing the money, globalizing the military, is their effort to try and control food. And I think it's
yes.
that effort to control food that has really stalled. It's bogged down in the politics of India. It's bogged down in the politics of Europe. And I think it's one of the reasons they may be, I think the G20 strutting their stuff in the last 2 years combined with the food thing stalling is part of this swinging of the pendulum back into North America. The
yes.
North America stuff they were clearly planning on doing, but I think they finally realized, look, For national security stuff, we got to build it here. We can't build it there.
Right.
But I would love your thoughts on what you think they're up to with food and what's happened to them on the food front.
Well, I think you're exactly right. when you were here, you suggested the idea that the plan had been to move away from petrodollars to GMO dollars.
Right.
And we saw this, and in fact, Dr. DeHart and I wrote about this in our book Transhumanism, because there was a big push on the part of WTO, the World Trade Organization, which basically is a puppet of the American government, to push American patent law as the standard for international patents, and particularly so in the case of GMO food patents. So you had, you know, the big agribusiness giants pushing these types of deals on the G20 in particular. And what they ran into, and what that meant, of course, was that every seed that you would buy from, say, DuPont or Monsanto or whoever would have been under these very strict royalty and licensing agreements. So in other words, they were, as you say, trying to get control of the food supply, and that in turn would have become a very credible basis to have a controllable resource as the backing for the reserve status of the dollar. But what happened, and something I don't think that they anticipated, was again the internet, you know, revolution, the ability of people to look into the so-called science behind GMOs and realize that the science was very dodgy to begin with.
Right.
And in some cases, in all honesty, particularly in the UK, we talk about the case of an individual scientist there that was basically told by Prime Minister Blair to shut up.
Right. Because, and he was fired.
And he was fired, yeah. And, yeah. You know, they got everybody after him, the Royal Society and everything. So the pushback on it, I don't think that they anticipated. And then, of course, once the dominoes started falling in Europe, it was first Germany and then France and Hungary and Poland, now Italy. More recently, I have a blog coming up about that in the next couple of weeks. Italy is joining in on limited bans of some of these GMO products. Russia, of course, is pushing there as well. And something that raises another issue, because, as you say, this is going to force them to retrench the manufacturing and everything back into North America.
Right.
There's another geopolitical possibility here, Catherine, that I see could possibly be coming down the pike, and that's to hit America in one of the few industries that it has left that it is that is a manufacturing and export industry, and that's precisely agribusiness, and GMOs
right.
were a big part of it. But the other thing I can almost guarantee that at some point we're going to see the BRICS nations, and probably Russia in particular, start to push, is to emerge on the world agricultural markets as competitors to GMOs by selling in a major way so-called heirloom seeds, the natural seeds that we used to plant and reserve some for planting next year during the harvest, the natural seeds that we had to spray with pesticides and everything to keep the pests off. I think there's a very good possibility that we're going to see the BRICS nations challenge that aspect of American financial hegemony
right.
by making those seeds available. So I think, and to kind of flesh out your scenario a bit more with that idea, I think they have probably already figured or seen this coming down the pike, and this may be another reason why they're trying to pull in as much as they can back here to North America.
Well, the pushback on the food is very, very, you know, I think the risks are out of the bag,
oh,
and
yes.
too many people know them, and it's a...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really stalled.
It's stalled, and you know, I think it's stalled that in such a way that I think you're right. We can't afford to ignore this idea of a breakaway civilization, and thereby this gives us a reason to connect dots between GMOs, 3D printing, the relaxation of the SEC rules and so on. All of this is tied together, and,
right.
and I think this is something people really need to latch onto, is to start thinking in this way.
Well, one of the things I believed that literally what we had seen with the explosion as we created so the WTO gets created in 95, mm-hmm. and the fraud which had been banned during Iran-Contra in the 80s sort of got cleaned up in the 90s, takes off again and explodes in ways that, you know, we never dreamed of before. I mean, it just explodes. And as it's exploding, you have this explosion, for example, of phony baloney, treasury paper, mortgage paper, other paper. It comes into the 2006, it crashes, we have the bailouts, and I called it a financial coup d'etat. And I think what happened with the bailouts was basically the Fed and the Treasury bought up all the phony baloney paper. You know, we couldn't have an RTC and auction it because there was just too much criminal liability, too much fraud. And they basically stick it back to the taxpayers, whether through the Treasury or through debasement through the Fed.
Right.
And you literally see the breakaway civilization walk away with an endowment which makes it, I believe, probably self-sustaining. In other words, they stole $40 trillion, and they've got $2 trillion a year to fund their operations.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think that what you're suggesting is that it has become a fully autonomous entity by this point. And I'm wholly in agreement with that, because everything I've been investigating, Catherine, from the angle of technology and the history of the people involved, which I get into in the most recent book in a major way, everything points in that very same direction. So it's coming really now from two different approaches, the financial approach and then the patterns that you see emerging with the people actually involved in that national security, black projects, covert operations apparatus. I wholeheartedly agree.
Let's step back. If you look at North America, you have two governments. You have one government that has, you know, $2 trillion a year of tax flow, or $1.5 trillion a year of tax flow from individuals and corporations.
Right.
And then, but they have all the liabilities. They have Medicare, they have Medicaid, they have Social Security, they have 100% of the liabilities.
Right.
Then you have another one that has, you know, $2 trillion a year of dividends and interest coming in, no responsibility to the population. They're invisible, they're secret.
Yep.
And their, you know, their responsibility is to build out space.
Right.
And whatever
they
that
have
means.
No liabilities.
Well, they they certainly have risks.
Yeah.
Because when you're running $40 trillion on a secret basis and running $2 trillion a year of operations and you have to stay invisible, you know, that's a very complex task.
Sure. Yeah. It's complex. It's risk.
Right.
But I think that what the idea of no oversight and no accountability is suggesting is, even if they did have liability, there wouldn't be any way to enforce it, because they've got the tools of enforcement.
Right.
So in other words,
they're above the law.
Yeah, exactly. They've broken away in precisely that sense. Exactly.
Now, my experience with that world, you know, and I only get little flashes, and somebody said, talking to me was like walking across a battlefield in the dark, and occasionally a flare went off and you saw a little snippet. And I said, that's because, you know, I only see little snippets, so I can only, you know, try and discern patterns from snippet to snippet. But, you know, to the extent that I've dealt with them, what I saw is they do absolutely have rules. Because when you're managing this much money and these many operations, you have to have process, you have to have rules.
Sure.
And so you have committees, and they're very planning oriented, you know, 100 years. They got a 100-year plan, they got a 50-year plan, a 25-year plan, a 10-year, you know, these are planning fools. And so they're planning, and they have committees, and they have process. And the big fights are when, you know, when two committee members find that each other have lied, you know, they've lied to the committee. Whew, those are some of the bad fights.
Yeah.
And, of course, the fights, it's like when the mafia, you know, fights and everybody goes to the mattress, it's bad for business.
Yep.
So, you know, there is some kind of law, even if it's completely divorced and very hard for us to discern from over on this side of the one-way mirror. Okay, well, let's then turn to the remaking of America, because you're now sitting I mean, imagine a picture of North America. We're sitting at Howard Johnson's and we're looking at the map. And if you look at the map, what you realize is you have two power centers. You have this overt federal government that's managing all the liabilities. And then you have this covert government, which has got a lot less financial liabilities. And I told you, when I left California, I drove through Texas. And 50 miles west of Dallas, up until 20 miles north of Dallas, you know, so for that 70 or 80 miles, you know, I've never seen as big a boom. And, of course, Dallas is black budget central. Right. I've never seen as big a boom. Every 1 to 5 miles, there's another Lockheed Martin-type headquarters. You know, one of these sort of, you can't tell what company it is, and it's got that glass so that they can't, the NSA can't listen. and they're just, there's one of after another going up, and the roads are all under construction. And, you know, and these guys are investing like, you know, tomorrow's going to be better than today. They are planning on a resource-rich world for a long time.
Somebody's building
out a major infrastructure, and it was very interesting because, you know, for years I've been scratching my head. Warren Buffett bought Burlington Northern, biggest railroad in the West, or one of the biggest railroads in the West. Then he took, you know, he basically bought the whole thing up. He took it private. I'm thinking, why does Warren Buffett want Burlington Northern? And then one of my neighbors got hired and to be an engineer in Burlington Northern, and I get the fact that the Memphis hub is going to be the number two in the country, and it's going to be huge. And so I'm thinking, major investment railroad, what's this all about? Well, when you and I talked, and the magic bell went off when you said, quote unquote, a high precision distributed manufacturing infrastructure, and I said, that's why Warren Buffett wants to own a huge railroad operation and have it be private. Because if you're going to have distributed manufacturing, and it's going to be expensive stuff, it's high precision stuff, you're going to have robotics, you're going to have big 3D printers, you need a high quality railroad. And that's big money. That's not a sleepy thing. That's a pretty exciting thing.
No, and the other thing I think that this portends too is I think you're going to see an increased move in the next 5 to 10 years to bring in or completely revitalize or revolutionize, it would be a better word, America's overt railroad system. And we're not even talking, you know, about what they may have underground, which I think probably is fairly extensive.
Carlisle in 2012, Carlisle, major breakaway civilization leveraged buyout firm, bought one of the short line, the biggest short line railroad in the country, or made a major investment. They didn't buy it, but, you know, so with Buffett going in 2009 and then Carlisle going in, it was 2012, big investment. What that says to me is, you know, the railroads are an integral part of building out this infrastructure. And it was funny, when I got back here, I went to see somebody who has experience in this area, and I said, okay, how much does it cost to build a jet fighter? He says, $60 million. I said, okay, how much does it cost to build, if it's $60 million to build a jet fighter, how much does it cost to build a UFO, basically a anti-gravity propulsion spaceship that can go really fast? He said, okay, maybe $600 million. I said, okay, if we build the kind of manufacturing infrastructure we think we can with 3D printer and robotics and, you know, all this material sciences, could we get that down to $60 million? And he said, well, you know, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, exactly. And I think ultimately that may be one of the scenarios that might be in play here. I look at this 3D printing revolution, Catherine, from precisely this material omission UFO scenario.
Right.
Because I'm thinking, why would you need a distributed high precision manufacturing infrastructure? Well, the answer, the long and short of it really is you don't need that kind of infrastructure unless you're thinking it might be under threat. And, you know, I'm thinking particularly in terms of World War II Germany, when the decision was taken circa 1942, when the Allied bombing campaigns are really getting underway, that you know, we need to break up these huge industrial plants that we've got in the Ruhr and in Silesia and so on, and disperse them in throughout the country and decentralize them, go to modular construction methods and put as many of them underground out of reach as we can. So in other words, they were taking an economic decision, but also a military one. And that's what this, in all honesty, Catherine, that's what this looks like to me. Now, the way I'm seeing it is I'm not seeing any potential geopolitical threat from China or Russia or anybody else. So I'm thinking that in their mentality, particularly with this breakaway group, and the fact that they've been dealing with a UFO phenomenon on an increasingly numerical basis since World War II, that they've got to get a handle on not only the technology, but the real factor is the production. And in the most recent book that I just finished, I'm arguing that it's not the technology so much that we might be behind in. It might be the ability to produce it inexpensively and quickly. And I think maybe that's part of what this 3D printing thing is about, because I'm absolutely convinced, Catherine, that that's coming out of the black world.
Right. Well, if you look at the push to make this technology fashionable,
yes,
to make it interesting, to get
exactly
kids learning about it,
exactly,
it's clearly coming top down. Mr. Global,
yes,
is trying to make this sexy, fashionable, and look like it's a grassroots explosion.
And yes, precisely. And they're trying,
right,
to do this as quickly as possible.
Right.
Which is the other fascinating thing for me is why the rush?
Well, I told you the story of the activist in Switzerland in 2010 who told me he'd just been given a grant from the Office of Naval Intelligence to go into minority community and get kids interested in becoming robotics engineers, that the Navy,
yeah,
estimated at that time that in 10 years they would need 400,000, or North America would need over 400,000 robotics engineers.
And again, the question is why?
Right.
You know, why do you need all of this vast surveillance capability? Why do you need this sudden dramatic expansion of robotics? And you know, when I think we should point out for the listeners that when we're talking robots here, we're not just talking the kinds that assemble cars and weld things and so on and so forth. We're talking street robots, effectively,
right,
and, you know, effectively androids.
Well,
right, the question is why? And I can only think again of two reasons, and the first one again is in the process of retrenching their home base, they have to have the ability to maintain the domestic peace of their home base in order for anything to work. And robots give you a unique advantage in that respect, because you're not dealing with human emotions or human individuals. You just program them and they carry out their function without any discretion or judgment sense.
Right.
But the other thing is I'm thinking in terms of this technology, in terms of space once again, because in a certain sense robots were the development of the space program. We've had to invent robotic space probes that are automated that can go to other planets and do our explanation and be our eyes and ears for us. So I'm thinking that this may presage yet another aspect of this collateralization of space, that they need a vast amount of robots to do the kind of mining that they want to do, and so on and so forth. So I think there's two aspects of it, and again, one of them has to concern space.
Well, let me talk about the finance side, because I think,
sure,
part of what's driving the train, you know, for 50 years we've had this enormous growth,
yes,
in the bond market with interest,
yes,
rates coming down, you know, fantastic. You know, you have to give them credit in terms of financial engineering. The financial engineering has been unbelievable.
Right.
And they have engineered lower and lower interest rates with a growing and growing bond market. And the reality is that game is pretty much coming.
It's over.
It's over. It's not quite over, but, you know.
It's getting there.
There's no more growth coming. And, you know, Mikey's saying, I can't believe I ate the whole thing. You know? So, he doesn't have food sickness yet, but he's full.
He's
getting there. So the question is, one of two things can happen financially. You can either have a long-term bull in equity,
right,
which will inflate you out, but it'll inflate you out by the value of the equity going up. Or you can have the world's worst crunch and depression. You can have the fourth turning that Neil Howe talks about.
Right.
And so to me, the question is, you know, they are much better off, I hope, engineering the equity bull.
Yes.
And that's why I think the crowdfunding and the way they're moving the technology out is so interesting.
Yes.
Because, in fact, they're moving it out. And we know, if you look at how much they stole, all they have to do is reinvest a little bit to get a long-term equity bull going.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So,
go ahead.
So, and part of it is they just shift the money out of the old economy. You know, they just move it out of the analog manufacturing into the digital manufacturing, and they double their money, they triple their money.
Yeah.
Because they're trading on inside information on this one.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly the kind of scenario that I think is taking place here. And, you know, again, if we factor in that material omission called space, UFO-style technology.
Then it makes sense.
Absolutely it does. I think it rationalizes the things that are going on almost as well as any other model that I've heard out there. So, yeah, I'm in total agreement with that.
It's funny. I just
got to do that.
I just watched a very inspiring video from the BBC. Mm-hmm. It's called The Seven Wonders of the Industrial World. And we're going to use it for Let's Go to the Movies on the Salieri Report. Uh-huh. And one of the projects, it describes the detailed engineering on, most of them were in the 19th century. But one of them was the Hoover Dam.
Oh, yeah.
And what I hadn't realized was that to build the Hoover Dam, they had to build four tunnels. You know, it was a consortium of six companies, including Bechtel. And they had to build two tunnels on both sides of the Colorado River to route the water so that they could, you know, dry things up enough to build the main dam.
Right.
And, you know, it was an amazing tunneling feat. And I suddenly realized, wait a minute, the Hoover Dam is right next to Las Vegas. So it's right, you know, it's right near Nellis Air Force Base. So Area 51. So these guys learn how to tunnel here, and the next thing you know, suddenly tunnels are popping up all over Nevada.
Yeah, and tunnels, not only tunnels, but secret military bases.
I guess, because when you have a big contract like that, you always try and get more big contracts to do what you were doing on the last big contract. I thought, oh, that's how the tunnel thing happened in Nevada.
Well, and, you know, speaking of tunnels and the technologies that would enable them to do things on that scale that you're suggesting. One of the things that I talked about in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations was a new kind of boring technology that didn't rely on, you know, the rotating diamond head discs, crunching up rocks, and then sending the slag on a conveyor belt to the back of the borer, you know, to be hauled off
right.
the dump trucks.
Right.
What they've come up with, and Bechtel, incidentally, was one of the corporations that had patented some of these things, and I'm guessing they have probably built them, is they use a nuclear reactor in these things to create a hot plasma, a jet, quite literally, of hot gas that literally melts its way through the rock.
Right.
And as it melts, the rock cools and creates a kind of ceramic glaze that actually functions as a stiffening to the tunnel. So in other words, you know, you don't have the slag, you don't have to haul anything away, you're boring your way literally through any type of rock that you encounter, and there's no limit to it. So in other words, yeah, I think that the technology is there. As you say, they've created these huge power installations close to these things. And
right.
with that kind of technology, you could bore all sorts of underground infrastructure to connect these various bases. Absolutely.
Right. And all you have to do is come up with an explanation to the people up top about what's causing the sinkholes.
Exactly. Or, you know, why is my house rattling at 3 a.m?
Right. Or how did the Secretary of State get from the West Coast to the East Coast in 2 hours without taking a plane?
Without taking... Yes. That's a good one. I'm still waiting for the explanation on that one. Yeah, and I don't think it was in an SR-71 Blackbird either. Because you would have seen that flying in
there. Yeah, there are all sorts of time calculations that don't make sense until you start. So let's just turn on the equity model. I talked about this turn in the bond market, which I think is part of this. Because if you're going to keep control, you need to come up with a next. You can't just let the bond market collapse without a next. You need a... And, of course, the way to do it, I think, is to inflate the equity. But the other thing is, one of the things you've done with the financing of the black budget, you know, you've basically harvested places.
Yes.
You've brought in drugs. You've brought in the lottery. You've brought in, you know, all sorts of arms trafficking. You've brought in mortgage fraud and organized crime. And then you've done a lot of things with government money that's really... you know, destabilized and drained the local economy, and you've made money from bringing in franchises and big box stores, and you've made a lot of money. So you've done all of those things. If you're going to bring in this kind of manufacturing and reinvigorate places, the increase in the value of equity of the land and real estate is enormous.
Right.
And in the 90s, when I was prototyping community venture funds, it was clear to me when you brought in digital technology, you could get an explosion in the value of the land and real estate. And when I watched them pump and dump the mortgage markets, I thought, oh, you know, they see this too. And what they want to do is they want to get a hold of as much real estate and land as possible at rock bottom price so that when they bring in this technology and they bring in this investment, you know, that's one of their biggest plays, making money on the real estate.
Yep.
And I wanted to bring up what happened with New Orleans and Katrina, because New Orleans is the port that is at the bottom of the Mississippi, which is where the American heartland empties out to.
Right.
And we're the breadbasket, you know, we're probably the richest breadbasket of the world at this point. And I'm also seeing a lot of consolidation in ownership and control of farmland.
Oh, yes.
And so, to me, there's an effort going on, both, you know, residential real estate, commercial real estate, and farmland, to get control of a lot of land and real estate before this thing really gets going.
Right, right.
We saw, you know, we've seen big institutional investment, you know, picking up lots and lots of foreclosures. And you have so many people watching the housing market waiting for prices to collapse.
Right.
And it, you know, it has not happened yet, and I think it's probably not going to, because there's too much they want to accumulate.
There's too much they want to accumulate, but let's go back to New Orleans for a minute, because I think there's another aspect here that people may not be aware of that they need to be aware of. When Katrina was tracking through the Gulf, if you recall, it made a rather sudden, dramatic, almost 90-degree turn northward to New Orleans and hit the city. And I'll be very blunt, Catherine, I and many other people at the time thought that that just was not normal behavior for a storm.
Right.
In other words, it was steered there. And I think given what happened subsequently in that city and the, quite honestly, just deplorable, almost criminal response of the, or non-response, you should say, from the government, I think it was precisely as you say. They were attempting to drive everything down there. They were using weather to do it. It was kind of a test run, so to speak, for their weather manipulation in conjunction with some of these long-term financial and economic goals. So, you know, I had a friend in New Orleans at the time, and the value of his property just plummeted.
Right.
And, had to leave, and it was brought up. Well, if you've got the ability to do this, then, yeah, you move in, as you say, in New Orleans, you rebuild it, it becomes an even larger port facility than it has been. And you're going to do this and see the same thing with the other Gulf ports, Houston, Galveston, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I'm in total agreement there. And what bothers me with that kind of scenario that I'm suggesting here, Catherine, is if they've got the technology and are experimenting in that way, I wouldn't put it past them to use it in that similar way to buy up this land, as you're saying.
Right.
And you know, to do.
Oh, I think they are.
Oh, I totally agree with you.
You know, the beauty is when you bring, if you do a Katrina or you do the tornadoes,
right,
you can literally write off hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of federal mortgage debt that's fraudulent. It gives you the wide latitude under the laws to, you know, kind of cover up, paper up, move money in, and basically, you know, relieve the debts of all that fraudulent paper and make a whole bunch of reinvestment, you know, so you lose the liability, you gain control of more land, and you get free financing to make improvements on that land. It's kind of a win-win-win-win.
It's the ultimate implausible deniability. You're in effect using acts of God or acts of nature to wipe out fraud.
It's knowledge management.
Exactly. It's just the sort of devious planning that you suggested when you were visiting. You know, these kinds of multifunctional piggybacked operations that they pull, and you know, this would be yet another instance of it. And in Katrina's case, I think we were served up kind of the trial run, and then we saw other instances of it around the rest of the world. I think Fukushima, you know, we talked about that the last time, and I definitely think that the Fukushima thing was in that category.
Well, the financial patterns and the geopolitical patterns in and around Fukushima certainly raise concern. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Well, let's turn a little bit to me and you. You know, if I'm listening to this and I'm you're thinking, oh my word, you know, well, first of all, obviously you sell your bonds and you go long equity.
Yes. I haven't bought any bonds lately.
But I think, you know, when you step back and you look at this, what you realize is the Teutonic plates are shifting financially and economically.
Yeah.
And if you look at the imperative, you know, you've got a group of people who are above the law, who have extraordinary, you know, they're very resource rich. They're not in financial trouble at all.
Right.
But they do depend on the machinery. They do depend on the custodian systems. They do depend on the banks. So they can't, you know, they need the system to function. And they are in a hurry. There's a lot they want to see happen, and they're in a hurry, and they're pushing hard.
Yes.
And so the reality is, you know, I look at this and I say, if you disagree with what they're doing, you do not want to have a frontal fight with them.
Well, no, certainly not.
Right.
I think, you know, for people distressed by what's going on, I think the long-term view, the cultural view, is best. You know, let them do what they're going to do and have their toys and push their buttons.
Right.
Because at some point, you know, if they keep on the course that they're keeping on now and remain totally non-responsive and oblivious to the people, they're going to wake up one day, just like they did in Warsaw or Moscow, and they're going to be pushing buttons and levering levers and phoning people, and nothing will happen because they've lost the people.
Right.
You can have all the power in the world, but at some point enough is enough, and nothing's going to work. And I think maybe to a certain extent they've woken up and realized this. I certainly hope they have.
I don't know, and I can't tell, because I intermittently go in and out of different groups.
Yeah.
And I'm always struck by how, within any particular group or person or enterprise, people are so caught up in the piece that they're responsible for.
Yes.
That there is a remarkable lack of the big picture. Now, what happened with the bailouts was the alienation of the general population from the leadership was extraordinary.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And yet, the next election came around, and of course, the general population fell into the I call it Monsanto, Goldman Sachs right versus Monsanto, Goldman Sachs left. And, they fell into the trap again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and to me, the propaganda, the entrainment technology, it's all very powerful. So, but I do think there is an extraordinary alienation, and I think part of that alienation comes from people thinking that the problem is corruption, as opposed to the problem is literally an entire breakaway civilization that has a separate goal that we can't fathom.
Yes, and I totally agree with that, and that's why I think having this type of discussion is so important, because I think to a certain extent, Catherine, most people really don't think in terms of the black budget because it doesn't have an immediate effect on them.
Right.
But if they start thinking in terms of the things that we're enjoying now in terms of technology, desktop computers, cell phones, things of this nature, most of these things at some point had a connection with black projects and black budgets. The modern computer is really kind of a legacy of what was going on in Great Britain and Germany during World War II.
Right.
Because they were building and designing these things to crack each other's codes and figure out neutron paths for atom bombs all sorts of stuff. But all of these things that we're enjoying ultimately are products of black budgets of one sort.
It's, I have to tell, I don't know if I ever told you the story. I had a great breakfast meeting with a family, and the father was a retired general who at one point had been head of the Lockheed group down at Orlando next to Disney World. And you could tell he was just so depressed about the fact that they would invent something and then give it to Disney and then Disney would get credit for it. Said, well, everything you love from Disney, we it was invented first for the military. We did it, but we had to give Disney credit. Disney was the cover story.
Well, that's, when you stop and think about the enormity of that.
Well, I'll tell you, very interesting. I've been watching all these DVDs on engineering and manufacturing through history.
Yeah.
And I was watching, I'm always amazed when you want to bring out, a system where everybody maintains and creates and manages for you their personnel file in the intelligence agencies.
Right.
So Facebook is, the ultimate op. Well, the internet's the ultimate op, but Facebook is the way you get everybody to update their own file. And it's very cost effective and much, better than anything you could do. And so you need a face, and you need to make it look like this entrepreneur was just a brilliant, and he started it, and he ran it, and it all succeeded, because he's like this noble person. So I'm watching this DVD on history, so you whether it's the guys at Google or Mark Zuckerberg, they're just, it's almost like they're the patsy.
Yep.
And sometimes you even wonder, do they know they're the patsy? And so I'm watching this story of Alexander the Great, And I realize his father is, you know, is the emperor, is in control. He gets assassinated, and suddenly, the young Alexander is the emperor, and he's running around doing all these amazing things, conquering. And I thought, oh, I get it. Alexander the Great was the Mark Zuckerberg of his.
Yep.
Because whoever took out his dad, you know, proceeded to engineer everything with this poor young kid in front.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. I totally agree.
I said, this has been going on for centuries.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. it's social engineering, and you know, every now and then they get carried away and they lose the connection with the people, or they manage to so anger and infuriate everybody else, you know, all the other countries around them, that they all gang up and say enough is enough. So, you know, we're kind of in that stage, but I kind of see or sense them, just from what we've discussed with the GMOs, with the pullback, the 3D printing, the crowd financing regulations that are going to be coming down the pike. I kind of see them deliberately retrenching and doing so, or trying to do so, in a hurry. I haven't quite figured out why the big hurry. That's what has me.
There is a very big hurry, and I think the reason, you know, it was clear to me after the election that they had promised, you know, basically the administration had promised the people who had engineered the election for them that they would deliver gun control. I mean, that was clearly a tit for tat. And the push after the election for gun control was quite extraordinary, and it was a big failure.
Yeah.
So if you look at the bets they're making in terms of the manufacturing, the energy, what the Trans-Pacific Partnership might bring, you can absolutely see why gun control is a major, major issue.
Yeah.
Because they are afraid of the population. And
oh, yeah. Yeah, I think they are. And I think it's a narrow window, really, that they're confronted with, because, and I think probably a 5 to 10 year window, because the cynicism against the overt government, the government that assumes the liabilities, is at an all-time high. I just heard today, for example, that Congress, the House of Representatives, had passed a bill essentially okaying all of the surveillance going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and talk about the political party in the majority in that House of Congress slitting its own throat as far as the people are concerned. I heard that, but I thought immediately of one of my cousins who is, I won't say he's Mr. Republican, but he's definitely on the conservative side of the political spectrum. And I can just imagine the effect that this will have on him, because he's also, you know, passionately libertarian when it comes to individual rights and freedoms. And, you know, I don't blame him. And my reaction when I heard the news about that vote was pretty much the same. That, you know, are you people nuts? Are you so out of touch that you don't realize what you're doing? So I think the powers that be have a concern, and this is why the big push for gun control. But if they can restructure the manufacturing and economic base of the country, as we've been suggesting, down the line, that cynicism and popular dislike of the overt government will dissipate, I think.
Yes,
I think maybe,
absolutely.
I think maybe this is the other reason.
Because you're talking about millions of jobs.
Yes, absolutely.
And reasonably paying jobs, and you're talking about literally trains and stock market profits.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So it's a narrow window. I think in terms of, you know, the short term, what's going to be interesting to see is how they're going to attempt to sell the two major political parties in the next election. That's going to be the interesting thing, because neither party right now is, as you know, terribly popular.
I have seen for my entire life, you come into every election and suddenly the notion that it's important you know, the Republicans tell you it's imperative that whoever the Democrat candidate, you know, so nobody's right. for their candidate, they're against the other candidate.
They're against the other one.
And, the right and left game, the divide and conquer game, always succeeds. I've never,
well,
and I, each time it happens, I can't fathom that it happens, but it engages in it's like it kidnaps mentally. It mentally kidnaps the mind and imagination of people who I thought understood what was, you know, the real game.
Excuse me. Yeah, I think to a certain extent that's true, but I think there's also something else abroad in the long term that has them concerned, and that is precisely they're losing their ability to play that game.
Right.
And they haven't come up with a replacement game. Almost as fast as they can think of anything these days. I mean, you know, let's face it. There are problems with the Boston Marathon story, the Boston Marathon bombing story. But one of the biggest problems, as far as the powers that be are concerned, is that no sooner had it happened than almost immediately everyone on the internet is questioning the official story.
Right.
And you know, this has only increased over the past few years, and with the growing division of the country between red counties and blue counties and so on and so forth, it's only going to increase. And I think over time what they're concerned about, Catherine, is a dwindling public participation or even interest in the election process. And that means they're confronted with a population that's increasingly wise to their game. I've been watching the election returns probably like you have, and
right.
I've noticed that each time around there's just a little less interest.
Here's their danger. The machinery depends on, you know, 20% of the population who are the hardworking, responsible, you know, the engineers.
Right. Right.
The doctors, the lawyer, the engineers. So you have this this class of mandarins. You know, there's sort of the American mandarins. They make everything work, whether it's a place or an enterprise.
Right.
If you, and I call them the people who hold up the world. They get up early. They work hard. They take care of their parents. They take care of their grandparents. They're active in the civic. They donate money for this. If you don't have them with you, the machinery stops working. I have one subscriber calls them the people on the line. You lose the line management, you can't execute.
That's right.
And it is very difficult to run, you know, $2 trillion a year operations in secret. It's hard enough, but if you lose them and they don't, you know, and that trust breaks down, you've got a major problem. And that's, you know, I keep coming back to what the Chinese call the mandate of heaven. You cannot afford to lose your mandate of heaven with the people on the line. And it's funny, too. Last summer, I went to see all the movies on alien invasion. You know, you had, was it Tony or Ridley Scott's Prometheus? And,
Prometheus.
You know, Men in Black 3 and blah, 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 blah. And I thought, you know, is this their way of trying to rebuild the man? Oh, we're really protecting you from the aliens, so you know, support us now. And you know, is this the struggle to win back the mandate of heaven?
That is kind of the question I attempted to address in this last book, Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations. And I kind of, to be honest, Catherine, I kind of dangle it out there that they're either confronted with something real on that score, or they're going to try to pretend or stage it. And I leave it pretty much up to the individual reader to make up their own mind which way it is. But the bottom line, I think, that you're suggesting here is if either one of those things is the scenario in play, the effect isn't really going to matter all that much either way, which is really true, because it's the effect on the culture that it will have that is the important thing. We don't really have to, you know, we don't even really have to go back to the public statements that President Reagan made on that very scenario about ET invasions and so on and so forth.
Well, we know we have UFOs flying around the planet. We know We know we have historical records and evidence that those UFOs have been flying around the planet for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yes.
So this is not new.
No, it's not new.
It's the not. Problem, somebody's doing it.
Well, here's what the problem really is, and I'm glad you brought up the perspective of history and historical records. Because at some point, as I argued in the book I just finished, and hopefully my publisher will do a quick turnaround on it and get it out there so that people can see the detail that I'm talking about. The problem that this breakaway group or the elite or whatever you wish to call them are going to have with the UFO is, first of all, they're going to do precisely what you suggested. They are going to go back and examine the historical record. They're going to go back and examine all the ancient lore and legends that would remotely, in their mind, have to deal or do with the phenomenon. And when they do that, the problem that they're going to be immediately confronted with is these were not very nice people.
Right.
and in that mentality, in the context of this Cold War matrix that's forming this breakaway civilization, the mentality is you have to dominate the situation. You have to prevail by any means necessary. So my take personally, Catherine, is that they took the long-term strategic decision that this time around, regardless of the purported claims of whoever's flying around in these things, doing these things, they are going to insist on an independent, sovereign humanity.
Right.
And I think, in all honesty, Catherine, that's what they're gearing up for in the long term.
Right, and it doesn't matter whether those UFOs are the remnants of the Nazis or...
Right.
In other words, we don't know that it's not a breakaway civilization, an older breakaway civilization of humans.
Right.
So we don't know that it's aliens, it could be other humans. But whoever it is, you know, they don't report to Congress.
That's right.
They're not being financed by or
right, precisely.
Right. So
whoever it is, they're going to, if necessary, resist.
Well, it's funny. I don't know if you've seen the new movie series about Stephen Greer and his experience, but there's this whole thing in it. It's very disturbing to me of, you know, let's all go sit in the desert and invite E.T. to come in and, you know, be civilized with us. And I thought, oh, I don't think that's a very good idea.
No, I don't either. I've read some of those ancient texts, and like I say, you don't want to sit down for tea with these people.
Well, it's funny because if you look at, you know, when I was sort of during my squabble, I constantly had, you know, various intercessions arranged by different members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And I used to look at the executive committee, who were people, you know, that I knew, that I wouldn't say they're close friends, but I thought, you know, if I had to choose between, you know, Bob Rubin and George Soros versus the E.T., I think I could deal with Rubin more easily.
Yes, exactly. And I think, really, you know, you put your finger on something there, because I think that is precisely the type of reasoning at work in this breakaway group. They may think that in some cases they're dealing with some other human breakaway group, and I think there's definitely that component to the phenomenon.
Right. Right.
But I don't think that accounts for all of it. So I think that process of reasoning that you just outlined with Soros and Rubin or E.T. is precisely what they're thinking. We at least know each other, and we're known quantities.
Well, I do think there's another possibility in the mix, and that is if you've controlled the global reserve currency and you have been able to do it with, you know, controlling the sea lanes and the satellites.
Right.
And you're looking down the road, you know, can the Navy continue to do that 20 years backing up a digital currency? You were going to use food. If you could get global control of food, that could replace it.
Sure.
But if you want to have a global digital currency in a world where everybody's getting this kind of weaponry and, you know, it's spreading, how are you going to keep controlling the reserve currency? And, you know, the other The other part of this could be what they're building is the military infrastructure that will allow you to do that on a long-term basis. Right.
Exactly. I think that really kind of hits the nail on the head right there, and that's kind of the thinking I'm suggesting in this book. I think that's precisely what they're doing. They're building the infrastructure. I think also, you know, with the surveillance capability, there's another aspect of this that you've suggested in your remarks, and that's the ability to monitor this technology for the sake of preventing it from proliferating into what they would regard as the wrong hands. Absolutely, I agree.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I just finished reading, there's a review of it up on the blog, Assange's book, Cyberpunks. And one of the things he talks about is the refusal by Visa and American Express and the credit card companies to allow a local clearance system in Russia, which means if Putin buys a Coke, you know, the data's in New York within 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And if you look at what they're doing with the financial settlement and clearance systems, they're maintaining phenomenally tight control of that stuff.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you've mentioned clearing, because in some of my blogs over the past year, I've suggested that one of the other things that we're going to see the BRICS nations, or as I like to call them now, BRICS, with the addition of South Africa, I think one of the things we're going to see them try to move to, or at least provide some sort of competition, is precisely clearing.
Right.
I think that that has to be. I mean, if they're going to be serious about any sort of pushback, that has to be one of the steps that they have in their immediate future.
Right. Now, I do have to bring up the Vatican.
Okay.
Which is, you know, it's hard to keep the Vatican brief, but we've watched the Vatican going through...
Yes.
You know, we're watching accelerating change, and as we pull the money out of the sort of old economy and put it in the breakaway civilization, build this new economy, you know, it seems to me that arguably the largest global bureaucracy in the world is the Vatican.
Easily.
You know, both the overt line and the covert line, and the Vatican is going through gut-wrenching change.
Yes, yeah.
And that's part of this, and maybe if you could tell us sort of what's happening to the Vatican and how that fits in with what the breakaway civilization is up to.
Well, I haven't really written any lengthy books or articles about it. My suspicion, Catherine, is more or less the same as yours. When you were here, you suggested that they're on the wrong business model. In other words, that they have the storefronts being the parish churches and cathedrals and missions and so on and so forth. That's a lot of overhead, and they don't have the financial base to sustain it. I suspect, and I'll be very blunt, and this is going to sound like the wildest speculation here, I suspect that part of the sexual scandals that have rocked the Roman Church in the past decade or so, actually longer than that if you really have been paying attention, but I suspect that a lot of that was engineered precisely by the Western financial elites. And I suspect that what you've had with popes like Ratzinger and this latest Pope Francis, I think what you have is an attempt by the Vatican to retrench itself. It's lost North America and it has lost Europe. So it's going to have to reestablish itself where its power base currently is, and that's in the Second World and the Third World. So to me, it's highly significant that you have a pope who is a Jesuit and from Argentina, because Argentina, for one thing, represents that extension of the European culture that forms the nexus of the Roman Catholic Church.
Right.
So that's significant. He's a bridge pope in a long-term move on the part of the Vatican to reorient its power base to the Second World and Third World. I think you're going to see probably now a succession of popes that are going to be from the Second World, And gradually that's going to transition to the third world. There's no doubt in my mind. And what I think this pope, when you see stories in the news about what this pope is attempting to do inside the Vatican bureaucracy, he's just like a president, only he, in a certain sense, he has a lot more power in that he can dismiss and reappoint the bureaucracy heads and chiefs
right.
of the various congregations as he wishes. His only real problem on a day-to-day basis with the governance of the Vatican City is the governance of the Vatican City itself is in the hands of a little committee of cardinals. So there's always that little bit of curial vested interest there. But I suspect what you have with this pope and what he's trying to do with the Vatican Bank in particular is to bring in to the curial system as much of that influence from the Second World, largely Latin America, that he can. And I think we're going to see that continue. I also strongly suspect something else, Catherine, and that is that there is a huge struggle for the actual control of the Vatican Bank, of the Institute
right.
for Religious Works. Somewhere along the line, and I suspect, quite frankly, that it goes back to 1920 line and the Concordat with Mussolini's Italy that actually recognized the Vatican as a sovereign state. I suspect that it was during that period, or perhaps a little bit before, that the Vatican lost control of its finances to a certain element within the Curia that represented less the interests of the Roman Catholic Church and more the interests of the international European Western financiers.
Well, but think of it this way, too, because you're talking about, you know, it's a little bit, I think of the Vatican business model as very much like the Harvard and University endowment.
Yes.
You've got 2,000 years of both global tax exemption and global
yep.
diplomatic immunity.
Yep.
And that gives you the ability to build a capital and endowment, much of which is, again, not covert. Because remember, you
yep.
had an empire recede, but what you left in place was a church with its endowments.
Yep.
And those endowments had tax exemption, diplomatic immunity,
yep.
and could basically move money on a secret basis globally.
Yes.
Now, the problem is they're coming up against digital technology, whether it's
yes.
the clearance and settlement systems or the telecoms and NSA, who can do it
right.
much more cheaply and build the control file systems much more cheaply than the storefront. So they're losing the preeminent control file and intelligence system to the digital guys.
Yes. Well, this is what I was getting to by them having lost control of the Vatican Bank. I think what's
right.
going on, and again, this is wild speculation. I haven't seen anything in the news or anything else, but it's in line with my speculation about the BRICS nations needing desperately and as quickly as possible to establish their own independent clearing. I think and suspect strongly, Catherine, that this is what you see.
Wow, they could do it through the Vatican Bank.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You
this
are
is
a genius.
What I, yeah, this is what I suspect is going on here.
Wow, that's very interesting because, you know, the if you look at the Anglo-American elite, they can't trump that.
No, they can't. And the other thing is the Vatican would be in a position to buy the technology to
right.
create that kind of clearing. The problem that they would have is, would that technology be secure? And, you know, coming from the West, probably not. So they're going to have to turn to the people with enough technical expertise that could vet the technology
right.
and make it secure. And to my mind, that means they have to turn to Russia.
They have to turn to Russia.
Yeah, exactly.
And what's interesting is if you look at the group that I've met around Putin, and or you look at the group in the Vatican,
right.
they both start off understanding and being committed to what you call the power of culture. That was one of the most amazing
yes.
insights when you started to describe that when I was we were together in California. It just, you know, more stars off in my head.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they do have a long view, and they have a view of the human race as the human as something special and sacred. Now, I'm not saying that they don't engage in dirtball politics and war like everybody else, but to me, their commitment to the power of culture gives them an enormous edge long run.
Yes.
That the Anglo-American elite has not figured out how to compete with.
No, and they won't. You know, you're dealing when you're dealing with, you know, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and, you know, all of these people. Let's remember that their idea of culture or art is Jackson Pollock. and you know, I'm sorry, they are purveyors of ugliness. They are purveyors of things that essentially dehumanize and deaden the human creative and artistic spirit. If you turn to Russia or you turn to the Vatican, the cultural investment there, the cultural heritage is deep and profound, and as you say, they have a respect for that aspect of humanity because it's not a materialistic thing. And this this is the big disadvantage.
It's a mystical sacred thing.
Yeah, you know, it's essentially the difference between an idealistic philosophical worldview and a materialistic one.
Right.
And, you know, I don't care how much science or equations you have. In the long run, humans are just not ultimately reducible to materialistic concerns, particularly on an individual basis. So I think in the long term they have a huge advantage. And Putin, you know, as I suggested to you when you were out here, Putin's coming out of that segment of the KGB.
Right.
That was, you know, most people don't know this, but in 1936, Stalin made one of the most incredible deals in history. And the deal was with a fellow by the name of Metropolitan Sergius, who was the locum tenens, the Metropolitan Archbishop, that was in charge of the Moscow Patriarchate, which had not elected a patriarch after the death of Patriarch Tikhon during the revolution. And Stalin's deal that he offered the church, seeing Nazism, you know, coming to the fore in Germany and a long-term challenge that it would present, Stalin knew that culturally, Orthodoxy had basically midwifed Russia into existence. You cannot think of Russian culture without Orthodoxy.
Right.
And in that sense, Bolshevism was just, you know, on the economic front alone, it was a gigantic step backward. Stalin's deal with the church was, okay, we'll allow you to open up a few seminaries here and there and a few churches here and there with government approval. In return, you are going to allow the KGB, then it was known as the NKVD, but the same thing, you are going to allow state security to recruit your clergy as domestic spies and security. Now, to us in the West, this would seem, on the part of the Russian church, a horrible, horrendous betrayal. But if you stop and think about the long-term implications of what this meant, it meant that the department of the KGB that was responsible for monitoring religious affairs inside of Russia, inside the Soviet Union, eventually was staffed by nothing but church people. It would be like the FBI saying, okay, we need to recruit a bunch of Mormons to keep an eye on the Mormons. Pretty soon, you've got a huge amount of the FBI being run,
right,
you know, by the Mormons. So Putin is coming out of this area of the KGB, where the church was viewed as the repository of Russian tradition and culture. And this is what people don't understand about the man. This is not, he's not a throwback, he's to Stalin or any of that. What he's a throwback to, really, in a certain sense, is Peter the Great.
Right, right. No, I agree.
Yeah, so, people have to understand this.
Right, so I think the You know, the $64,000 question in my mind is, how is the Anglo-American Alliance going to win the Mandate of Heaven?
Well,
big question.
Yeah, that is the $64 trillion question. and quite frankly, Catherine, I don't see them being able to do so unless they are willing to expand the box of their thinking in ways that up till now have just been inconceivable. I think the problem that you have with these people, Catherine, in all honesty, is they have surrounded themselves for so long with their trilateral commissions and their councils on foreign relations and their Royal Institutes of International Affairs and on with people of a similar or like worldview to themselves that they no longer are able to think outside the box. So unless they're willing to bring in genuine dissent into their circles, they're not going to be able to do it. I really don't think that they are. And that dissent, they cannot simply wall that dissent off inside their secret meetings. They have to allow their decisions to be opened up and publicly scrutinized. Otherwise, you know, they're going to end up going the route of all tyrannies in the past, and they ultimately fail regardless of how much wonderful surveillance technology that they have.
Right.
Ultimately,
force is not good enough.
No, force is never able
force
to.
And one of my allies calls it treats of the tapeworm. Tapeworm
yeah.
treats and force is not enough.
Yeah, it never is. And, you know, this is a lesson. They think that, you know, one more time and this time it's going to be different. Well, you know, I'm sorry. I just don't see it that way.
I think just to close out what this means to you and me and people listening, you know, we've got a financial and economic and technological tsunami that's brewing.
Yes.
And it's a big thing. It's a, you know, just as the financial coup d'etat was big, just as the bailouts are big, this is also big.
Yeah.
And you need to not, you know, we used to, at Hamilton Securities, we used to have a concept called the data beast. And the data beast was an invisible hippo that would land. And suddenly people would start fighting. And I said, wait a minute, instead of fighting with each other, you need to say, ooh, you know, I feel a tail. And another says, I feel a foot. And you say, yeah. Ooh, it's a hippo. You know, we need to not squabbles with a, so let's say the big corporation comes into your local area and they want to do something and eminent domain starts, and you need to understand that what's behind this is a much bigger force that has the capacity to send in hit teams to clean out your neighborhood.
Yes.
You know, we're dealing a whole different level of operation.
Yeah.
And so we need to be much more creative, nimble, and savvy about seeing this. And you know, this is going to have to be judo to kind of deal with this. And, you know, falling into the Tea Party rhetoric is not going to be enough.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So I think step number one is to see the full fury of what's up.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Stepping into the traditional political rhetoric of, you know, oh, it's the Constitution or individual liberty or free market, you know, these are the labels by which we have been manipulated. And
right.
we cannot, you know, we simply cannot afford to believe that we're living in that America any longer. We haven't really been living in that America since they murdered Kennedy in cold blood and got
right.
away with it.
Right. But I do want to say one thing. They depend tremendously on, you know, for the building and manufacturing and operation of the whole economy, they depend tremendously on contract law and laws.
Yes.
And so what always amazed me, and I discovered this during the litigation, you know, I grew up seeing some of the covert side and thinking sort of courts and laws was a joke and you just manipulated and killed people and told them what to do, and they did it. And it wasn't until I got embroiled in, you know, 18 different investigations and 12 different pieces of litigation, I discovered this thing called the law is really serious, and they take it really seriously, and it's not so easy to just you know, rig it and ram it. And what I will tell you is you'll see people blithely come along and say, oh, let's have a constitution and reinvent the constitution. No, there are still, as, you know, as yes. corrupted as it is, there are still enormous protections under that. And you don't want to change that until, you know, so we have a covenant both culturally and legally with each other within the Constitution. And I take it very seriously because I know how much protection it affords, and if they can pull down those protections,
yeah,
you know,
I didn't
watch
mean
out.
To imply, no, I certainly
yeah.
didn't mean to imply that we should all be rushing for a new constitutional convention. No. You know, if broke as it is, you don't want to make it more broke.
So let's just turn to the price of gold. We talked about bonds, stocks. We've talked a little bit about land and real estate. I think it's fair to say what we're looking at, whether it's how much gold exists, how it's being used and traded, because I think in terms of settlement among the breakaway civilization, mm-hmm. it's very important. And I think one of the things we've seen with the attack on the tax havens and the pushing precious metals down is a squabble going on between the legacy government and the breakaway civilization.
Yes.
Because the breakaway civilization has a lot of their money sitting in those offshore havens, and they got a lot of money sitting in precious metals.
Yep.
And you know, the U.S. Fed is saying, well, if Germany and Venezuela wants their gold back, and you guys are sitting on these big stores of precious metals, you know, sorry, we're going to exercise some power here. So we're seeing a little tug of war. The governments are saying, look, you can't take all this money offshore and not pay taxes and stick us with the bill.
Right.
You know, we want tax money. And so you're seeing a fight between the overt and covert side of the house.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Which is why I have to laugh because, you know, they had declared war on the IRS and were ready to throw Holder out. And suddenly you had the tornadoes out in Oklahoma and it stops.
Yeah.
I said, what was that? Okay, well, any other comments on gold? Because I think this tension is at the heart of the what we're seeing in the management of the gold price.
The real bottom line, deep historical philosophical question about gold remains: why do humans value it?
Right.
And I'm going to be very blunt and make a suggestion here. If you look at my book, The Philosopher's Stone, I talk about an actual modern-day rediscovery of a form in which gold exists as a fine white powder. Now, if you read alchemical texts, this is exactly one of the forms that they will speak very explicitly is a manifestation of the philosopher's stone. Okay? Now, what this white powder gold is, Catherine, is it's gold that has been consumed, literally burnt. And to do that requires enormous heat. I think it's around 8 or 9,000 degrees Fahrenheit to literally burn and reduce gold to a fine white powder. But when you do so, something amazing happens, if you believe the reports. The reports are that the element remains able to react chemically like it always did. But when you attempt to weigh it, it has lost 44% of its mass. Now, stop and consider the enormous implications of that. Because in losing that amount of its mass, something else also happens. The scales on which you weigh it also lose their mass.
Really?
Uh-huh. Now, I go into some theoretical physics papers that Hal Puthoff published regarding some of this phenomenon, and I talk about this stuff in, like I say, in my book, The Philosopher's Stone. But the bottom line is, there are stories out there, in other words, that suggest that gold is valuable because it has contrabaric or anti-gravity properties in a certain state of matter in which few people really know that it can exist. And if this be true, then it would stand to reason that this breakaway civilization would want to get their hands on as much of this stuff as they possibly could. Because if that's the ultimate real reason for its value, then yeah, it would be something you'd be trading with ET. It'd be something you would possibly be employing in your breakaway civilization technologies and so on and so forth. So I think, again, the hidden story even there may be the UFO.
So it's like the spice in Dune.
It's like, yeah,
you're mining the spice because you need the spice to travel the universe.
Precisely.
Right.
Precisely.
Well, it's I really appreciate very much your joining us today because
well,
I think
thank you for having me back on. It's always fun.
I think when you sit back and you connect the dots between all these different threads that are coming together, you see the enormity of what is happening and the shift. Mm-hmm. And when you have that kind of perspective and you see it clearly, then you can start to come up with strategies of, okay, you know, what does this mean for my skills? What does this mean for where I live? What does this mean for what I do? What does this mean for how I invest money? You know, where is my strategy to get fresh food? You know, all these practical things. And I think having the kind of perspective you get from this map is enormously helpful. So before we close, though, I want you to walk us through... Mm-hmm. Your website, your books, how do we get access to all this material? How do we follow you? How do we learn? How do we connect Dr. Joseph Farrell into our ongoing intelligence network? You know, if they have the CIA, we want to have Dr. Joseph Farrell. How do we plug in?
Well, I have a website. It's www.GizaDeathStar.com. That's G-I-Z-A, and then the words Death Star. And when you punch that in, it's all one word, and it's all lowercase. And on my website, there's actually a web store that has all of my books right there on the website, so you can order all of my books right there off the website. And I have... I do try and do a daily blog on this or that topic, so you can also go to the website.
I link to a lot of your daily blogs on my website, so...
Yeah. And thank you.
It's great, because I'll read yours and I say, oh, good, I don't have to write about that now, here it is.
Well, I'm kind of the same way. People send me articles and materials by email all the time, and actually I get so much email material that way that I don't have the time to research anymore. So usually what you're seeing on my site is a reflection of things that people have sent me and that they're interested in. But, you know, it's kind of a synergy thing going on because you can see people's interest and are kind of trending in the same directions that we've been talking about.
Yeah. And tell us the books that are coming out. Now, are the books that are coming out available for pre-order on your site?
Yeah, not on my site, but they are at Amazon. I don't actually put up a book on my site until it's actually available.
It's actually available. Okay.
Yeah, I have two books coming out, hopefully between September and October of this coming fall. The first book is a book that's in the series that we talked about. It's called Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilization. And the subtitle to that is UFOs, Oligarchs, and Space Secrecy. And then another book coming out more or less at the same time, I imagine, is a book called The Financial Vipers of Venice, which is that's going to be an intriguing book for many people because it's kind of an exploration of the links between banking and bullion and hermeticism and... Why you have an interesting link between the idea of coins and alchemy, and it's not what people would imagine.
Right. It's the story of Venice is a very interesting story. It was Venice that invented and created the insurance industry. And
yep. It's double entry accounting.
Yeah. It's yep. extraordinary, extraordinary story. And to think that they would be run out of town by American tourists.
yeah, that's true.
It's a beautiful city, a beautiful city. Anyway, well, Dr. Farrell, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Solaria Report. This has been very instructive. In combination with part one, it's been, it's not only been an extraordinary mapping of what's going on that I think can give anybody perspective, but it's really been very inspirational because, you know, I always walk away from talking with you saying, well, you know, I can understand my world and we're not alone and we can figure this out and we can do this. So I always leave with this excitement about what we're going to be able to accomplish in this next period. So I can't thank you enough for everything you're doing. And if there's anything that I or the Solaria Network can do to support you in doing it, I hope you will always let us know.
I will, and thank you for having me back on, Catherine. Fun as always.
Have a great evening.
Yeah, you too.